Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
It's 94.1 Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. And we have two special guests, one in the studio, one on the phone lines. The author of a very controversial book, Labyrinth. It deals with the Los Angeles Police Department, Suge Knight, gangs in L.A., the Rampart Scandal. I mean, this is a book that covers it all. And we have the authors here. And first of all, welcome to Hard Knock Radio. Randall, we had you on a month ago.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
And you're a writer for Rolling Stone on a regular.
Yeah,
right?
I've been a contributing editor at Rolling Stone for 20 years.
That's quite a time. That's older than some of our listeners.
Yeah,
you know?
I bet it is.
And on our phone lines, we have, I'm not sure if you're in Los Angeles, but former detective for the LAPD, Russell Poole. You're the main person that was the centerpiece in this book. How are you doing?
Pretty good, Davey. Thanks for having me on.
You know, I read the book. It raised a lot of questions. You cover a lot of ground. You leave a lot of questions to be answered. It's also been criticisms as well as praise. What is the book about? You know, what was the whole intention of the book? I'll start off with you, Randall.
I would say the intention of the book was to demonstrate that a lot of investigations that should have been done were not done, that the media...
Done about what?
Well, specifically about the murders of Biggie and Tupac, but also the involvement of LAPD officers and police officers from other departments with death row records in connection to at least Biggie's murder, if not Tupac's. About how the Rampart scandal was in a lot of ways an overlay on a much more disturbing scandal. It had to do with these police officers working for death row records. And it's about, ultimately, I think the book's about how racial politics actually worked against black people, even though it was black people who were pushing the agenda, black leaders. I think the victims didn't have much of a voice, and they happened to be black, too.
So where you pick up on this story after the March 9th, I guess it was 97, death of notorious B.I.G., Biggie Smalls.
Correct.
Took place after the Soul Train party, after party.
Right.
I can't remember the name of the place. It was like a museum.
The Peterson Auto Museum.
Right. And that left a lot of questions. I mean, almost from the start. I mean, we're talking about a guy who was the rival to Tupac Shakur, who died 6 months to a day earlier. There was a lot of speculation that people connected to Tupac had something to do with it, and raised even more questions for me personally, because I knew Biggie and I knew Pac. I did an interview with Biggie 4 days before his death, and he seemed to definitely be in a definite, a different headspace. You're talking about a guy who on record said a lot of things that we would equate to gangster rap, but when I was talking to him, he seemed like he was ready to make a change and move into a different direction. The real controversy that came up for me was there were a lot of people that I know that were down there when this happened. And so maybe I can ask you, Detective Poole, were you immediately assigned to investigating the notorious B.I.G. case?
No, I wasn't. Wilshire detectives were initially assigned the case, and I received the case 30 days after the killing.
Were you aware of what took place during the first 30 days immediately afterwards?
Well, yes. When the case was reassigned to Robbery Homicide Division, we obtained all the materials that had and clues that had been obtained up until then and studied all the material.
Were there an initial conclusion? Well, I guess it wasn't a conclusion, but an initial understanding of what may have happened?
Well, right from the get-go, the detectives believed somehow Death Row Records was involved. And of course, there was speculation that possibly Compton Crips were involved in the killing.
Okay. Were they able to get any of the people that were there? When I remember people from up here went down to that event, and many of them came back to the Bay Area saying that they were near, or around, or heard, or seen things that took place. But none of that stuff ever seemed to come up again, you know, after that first couple of weeks. And I wanted to know, from a police standpoint, did you find that there were a lot of witnesses to this, or just people who said things and then didn't want to talk on record?
Well, you know, anytime you get a high-profile case, you're going to get a series of clues that come in. And, for example, I worked on the Ennis Cosby case, and there were over 1,500 clues that came in on that. And, of course, one of the clues turned out to be the right clue out of 1,500. Mm-hmm. And so same thing on O.J. Simpson. Prior to that, you had thousands of clues coming in. And you have to study each one, and you have to follow up on each clue. And, of course, in this case, the real break in the case was the arrest of David Mack for a bank robbery out in Los Angeles.
Now, for people who aren't familiar, who is David Mack? Maybe you could explain this, Randall.
David Mack was an LAPD officer who had once been a world-class track athlete. In fact, he was number one rated 800-meter runner in the world. And right before the 84 Olympics, hurt his leg, was persuaded to join the LAPD, and had a pretty impressive police career, it seemed, until he was arrested for one of the biggest bank robberies in LA history, which he was caught on film committing. And after that, it came out very quickly that he was a member of the Bloods gang, mm-hmm. was a member of the Nation of Islam, which, being
David Mack was a member of the Nation of Islam?
Yes.
Okay.
And he proclaimed both those things immediately after his arrest to other inmates and to the cops as well.
Okay.
And had this connection to Death Row Records.
Right.
Which really was something he grew up with, because he and Suge Knight grew up in the same neighborhood. So when he was arrested for the bank robbery, Russell, and he can tell you this, you know, probably in better detail than I can, you know, got a lot of clues that linked David Mack to Biggie's murder, and linked a civilian associate of David Mack's as well.
So it seems like it would be an open and shut case, kind of, so to speak. But obviously this didn't take place. Why was that, Detective Poole?
Well, you know, during the course of the bank robbery investigation, I had interviewed the lead detective in charge of the bank robbery investigation, and he gave me a series of pieces of information that linked David Mack possibly to the killing of Biggie Smalls. One being the fact that when they did a search warrant on his house for the bank robbery, he owned a black SS Impala, and that's the same vehicle that was used in the killing of Biggie Smalls. Second mm-hmm. of all, in his garage, which was unusual for a police officer, he had a shrine of Tupac Shakur all over his garage. And that appeared to me unusual. Thirdly,
when you say a shrine, what do you mean?
He had posters, memorabilia, and it was well decorated inside the in his garage. And gang members dressed in red, flashing the West Side sign.
And Mack was dressed in red suits occasionally, and there were photographs of him.
Right.
And doing the West Coast sign.
Well, the West Coast sign doesn't mean you're in a gang. I mean,
doesn't necessarily. No, you're right. It means you're claiming a gang affiliation. You may not be actually a member, but you know.
When you throw up the W, well, I mean, that's shown in videos, and that, I mean, little kids do that.
Agreed. There's a lot of people playing.
And it was
that.
Actually popularized by Tupac back in the days when there was a supposed beef between the West right. and East Coast rappers. But, I mean, as far as I know, I mean,
Tupac was embracing a West Coast versus East Coast gang thing. I mean, it had a gang connection. I'm not saying it's entirely, but I mean, the West Coast sign actually did originate in gangs, and it spread into pop.
So it was a West Coast gang? Is that what?
No, the West Coast sign was what the Bloods and the Crips both would use against people that they who were not from the West Coast. You know.
Okay, so. You had all this stuff with this police officer, David Mack. But obviously, things didn't just end there. I mean, the guy's in jail now, right? But has he been charged with the murder of the notorious B.I.G.?
No, the investigation was stymied by the chief of police, Bernard Parks, and you know, there's a number of clues that connect David Mack possibly to the killing, and I requested search warrants to be done on David Mack's home, his financials, etc., and I was denied in doing so. And as time goes on, you try to figure out, well, why doesn't the chief want to probe any further into David Mack's life? And then you find out later, I found out information came in that Chief Parks had recruited David Mack on the job. David Mack had, he attended Oregon University and then later on attempted to make a comeback in track at USC, and that's where Chief Parks graduated. And Chief Parks was known for recruiting athletes onto the police department. And it turns out that where David Mack did his probation, officers had contacted me and said, hey, it was common knowledge that Chief Parks had recruited David Mack on the job.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade, the black O.J. Simpson, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, July 15th, 2021. So I have been told. This is our sixth book study session on Randall Sullivan's Labyrinth. Man, I have so many notes just on that one segment. Let's get right to the chase. Wow. So that segment, Davey D., longtime journalist, black male, victim of white supremacy, and again, victims guaranteed qualified. All of that said, Mr. Davey D., he had Randall Sullivan, suspected race soldier, and Russell Poole, suspected race soldier, as guests on his program. I think he said Mr. Sullivan on his program a number of times, but he said he read the book, and they go right, you know, to the questions. What was your purpose for publishing this book? And we heard Randall Sullivan, hey, I wanted to get out information about, you know, the investigations into the murders of notorious B.I.G., Christopher Wallace, and Tupac Shakur, handled poorly and not investigating the ties to death row, covering all of this up. And he says how racial politics worked against black people. What in just that right there would pause. What do you mean racial politics? And then the and then how racial politics pushed by black leaders. Ooh. Who are the black leaders? Put that in quotes. And Neely Fuller Jr., what did he say? All of the leaders of black people, non-white people, are classified as white. Facts. So that alone would have taken up about 20, 30 minutes. Then they say Death Row Records was involved. They ask, what did the enforcement officials, what did they conclude? And he, you know, stopped there. Suspect theory, what was the initial theory after the murder of notorious B.I.G. March 1997? And Mr. Poole says, well, they suspected Death Row Records was involved. Based on what? What? Is the, I mean, that's where it's got to be sentenced. That's what I mean. That's what I think we talked about this whole book. You can't just say things like that. Suge Knight, you know, did these killings and killed Tupac and killed Biggie and probably JFK and anything else we can think of. If he didn't do it, OJ did. Based on what? Word on the street? What some informant said? What Julius Butler told you yesterday? Like, are you serious? They continue. The Crips, same thing, that the Crips were involved. Based on what? Even if that's true, the evidence being, and why would that be their initial thought? And then, again, even what we read in this book, hey, if the Crips had done this, there's an offer for $25,000. He said, hey, a nickel. These Negroes would have turned out every Crip in the universe for a nickel. So $25,000? In the text, he says, hey, I don't think so. They would have told. If they knew anything, they would have told. Next. Incidentally, for Dave, and again, Davey D, victim of white supremacy, victim guaranteed qualified, but if he read the same book that we read, Labyrinth, maybe one of the first questions, so Notorious B.I.G., in your words, looks like something out of a minstrel show. Can you explain? Have you seen a minstrel show? Ooh. Ooh, man. Though, I mean, when I heard this interview, it made me so thankful for the context of white supremacy, because I think that's the way that white people are accustomed to being questioned when they are a guest on a non-white person's platform. I hope we do quality work here in asking tough questions. And, like, yeah, we read the book. Like, let's rock and roll. Let's get to page minstrel. Let's see. And we read all those segments. Remember last week where he talked about certain black people, like they had on allegedly an NOI, a Nation of Islam ring, and it was like dun dun dun, cue the sinister music, like uh-oh, like Nation of Islam niggers gang affiliate. And he'd already said in the text, like, a lot of the people who join the Nation of Islam, they do so out of prison, Detroit Red and all that. It's the same thing in the interview. He says, yeah, David Mack, yeah. Not only what did he have the shrine to Tupac Shakur, you know, not only was he affiliated with Death Row Records, he was staying with Shib White's estranged wife, but he also was a member of the Nation of Islam. Dun, dun, dun. Then he says, this is an Davey D, again, victims guaranteed qualified. He says, this seems like an open and shut case. Brothers and sisters, those of you who have listened attentively for the almost 2 months that we have been reading this book, have you heard one iota of anything that sounds like an open and shut case, in quotes, meaning conclusive evidence about anybody with regards to any of the murders that have been presented in this book? Maybe the Frank Liga, Kevin Gaines shoot. Like, it seems pretty conclusive. Frank Liga killed that black male. Other than that, conclusive? Open and shut? Victims guaranteed qualified. Maybe he didn't read the same book we did. Next, they said, David Mack, what evidence did David Mack, open and shut evidence, mind you, that David Mack participated in the murder of Notorious B.I.G. Christopher Wallace? He had a shrine to Tupac Shakur. Are you flipping serious? That's conclusive evidence. Are you... You can't even give me that he had certain types of bullets that were used in the killing. Like, that's not conclusive either, but you can't even give me that one. It's, he had a shrine and he had an Impala that may have been the same vehicle used. We don't know if it is the vehicle used. It may have been like the vehicle used in the shooting. That's conclusive. To a Negro that you have in greater confinement, I mean, it's not like this Negro's got a whole lot of secrets, I would think, about much of anything at this point. Although they did say he did not reveal the whereabouts of the stolen money and he has been released from greater confinement. So, let's see. Continuing. And then they even include former LAPD Chief Bernard Parks, black male victim of white supremacy, and saying, hey, he may have been a part of this black leadership cover-up in not wanting to expose David Mack because they're old track buddies, you know, and he likes to recruit these old Negro athletes. We even got the USC O.J. Simpson connection. Like, are you serious? I had a good chuckle on that one. Everything, one degree of Orenthal James Simpson. But I was appalled. I had listened to a different interview with Randall Sullivan, and I was stunned because I just felt like it was the same type of nonsense. Nothing was tied down to any definitive evidence, conclusive evidence about anything. It just seemed like a lot, the word on the street was this informant and this jailhouse informant convict said, you know, Julius Butler said, it was all that type of rhetoric and no serious inquiry. No, why did you say Notorious B.I.G. looked like he came out of a minstrel show? What do you mean, blackly? I mean, long list of questions that would be asked, but I generally don't hear that. I did send out an interview request to see if we could get Mr. Sullivan on the cows. Haven't heard back. I'm not surprised. We will get started. Context of white supremacy. Randall Sullivan's Labyrinth. Audio segment one.
Part four. Inventing the scandal. Poole has performed his duties in an outstanding manner. He is a dependable, hardworking, and loyal employee. His investigations are always thorough, and related reports are well written. Poole maintains a good attitude in the midst of the present turmoil with the department. He is extremely loyal to the LAPD and proud to be part of this organization. He works diligently to instill this attitude in those he works with and strives to achieve the department goals. From the performance evaluation report filed on Detective Trainee Russell Poole for the period 9/1/91 to 2/29/92. Chapter 9. Poole had first heard of Ray Perez on February 6, 1998, when he was given a list of LAPD officers who were closest to David Mack. At the top were Sammy Martin, a detective trainee in the Rampart Division who was the godfather to one of Mack's children, and Perez, an anti-gang detective assigned to Rampart who once had been partnered with Mack as an undercover narcotics officer. Perez had been involved in an officer-involved shooting, Poole was advised early on, in which Mack killed a drug dealer. When he looked at Mack's personnel file and read the official account of Jesse Vincencio's shooting, Poole was struck by a statement from Perez to the effect that he owed his life to David Mack and would do anything for the man. The lead detectives in the bank robbery, Tyndall and Grant, had called Perez in for questioning within 48 hours of Mack's arrest. A short time later, the detectives learned that Perez and Sammy Martin had left with Mack for Las Vegas 2 days after the bank robbery, staying in a $1,500-a-night suite at Caesar's Palace and blowing through $21,000 in a single weekend. On a similar excursion to Lake Tahoe, the three had posed together for a photograph, Mack in his blood-red suit, flanked by Martin and Perez, each of them holding unlit cigars. Like Kevin Gaines and David Mack, Poole soon discovered, Perez had for some time enjoyed a lifestyle that was impossible to support on the $58,000 annual salary he earned as a police officer. He drove expensive cars, took Caribbean cruises, lost thousands at the blackjack tables in Las Vegas, and apparently thought nothing of spending $4,000 or $5,000 in an evening to entertain one young girlfriend after another. During April of 1998, Perez realized that he was under surveillance by officers from the Internal Affairs and Robbery Homicide Divisions. He assumed this was because the department suspected he had been involved in the bank robbery with David Mack. Perez responded by marching straight in to tell his commanding officer that he had nothing to do with it. His fellow cops, however, weren't tailing Ray Perez on account of his possible involvement in the bank robbery, although they strongly suspected he had been one of Mack's accomplices. But because they believed he had stolen a large quantity of pure cocaine from the LAPD's property division. The investigation began on March 27, 1998, when a property officer at the LAPD's Evidence Control Unit realized that more than 6 pounds of cocaine checked out on March 2nd still had not been returned. In early April, LAPD officer Joel Perez was startled by an overdue property notice reminding him to return 3 kilos of cocaine he had checked out more than a month earlier. He hadn't checked out any 3 kilos of coke, Joel Perez replied. Shown a sign-out sheet bearing his name and badge number, the officer insisted it was a forgery. LAPD property officer Laura Castellano said she couldn't specifically recall the transaction in which she had released the 3 kilos and didn't recognize the photograph of Joel Perez she was shown. She did remember handing over a carton of narcotics to another Officer Perez, however, Castellano said. Rafael was his first name, Castellano told detectives. She remembered the man mainly because he had been so rude and arrogant, and she had remarked upon his obnoxious attitude to another property officer, who said he was always that way. Castellano also recalled the name of the supervising officer who released the coke to her. A check of LAPD records soon revealed that the three property officers had worked together on only one day in their entire careers, March 2, 1998. If Rafael Perez had picked up the cocaine on any other day, he never would have been detected, admitted Richard Rosenthal, the assistant district attorney who was eventually chosen to prosecute the detective. It was just bad luck. On April 16th, LAPD detectives discovered that a second carton of cocaine was missing from the property division, this one containing a pound of coke that on February 5th, 1998, had been sent by courier to Rampart Division, where it was signed for by Officer Armando Coronado. He had made no request for cocaine, said Coronado, who reacted viscerally when detectives asked him about his relationship with Ray Perez. Perez despised him, Coronado said, mainly because of his refusal to cut corners in dealing with informants and when searching suspects. Perez called him a company man, Coronado said, and on one occasion had threatened in the presence of several witnesses to kick my ass. Russell Poole was less intrigued by the enmity between Coronado and Perez than by the identity of the undercover detective who had booked the missing coke into evidence. His name was Frank Liga. Poole became convinced, as did several other robbery-homicide detectives, that Ray Perez had targeted Liga's coke as retaliation for the shooting of Kevin Gaines. We all agreed this was just way too big a coincidence, Poole recalled. Suddenly, the Los Angeles Police Department became very interested in knowing who and what they were dealing with here. Born in 1967 in Humacao, Puerto Rico, of African and Hispanic ancestry, Rafael Perez had never known his father. His mother, Luz, moved her three children to Brooklyn in 1972 and quickly relocated to Paterson, New Jersey, where Rafael spent most of his childhood. The family moved again just before Rafael started high school, this time to a very tough neighborhood in North Philadelphia, where they stayed in the home of an uncle who dealt drugs for a living. Despite his difficult background, Rafael Perez was a straight-arrow teenager who joined the Marine Corps immediately after high school. While stationed at the Marine Barracks in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, he met and married, at age 18, a young enlisted woman from the nearby Pease Air Force Base. Lori Charles was black and assumed, based upon his features and complexion, that Rafael was also. It was an early example of Perez's remarkable capacity for shape-shifting, especially along racial and ethnic lines. When his bride was discharged from the Air Force, her husband moved her to the Marine Air Corps Station in Tustin, California, Lori's home state. The couple broke up only 3 years into their marriage when Lori discovered Rafael's infidelity. In June of 1989, shortly after his wife had left him, 21-year-old Rafael Perez was accepted into the Los Angeles Police Academy. What made this remarkable was that Perez already had applied to and been rejected by several smaller police departments in Southern California after failing background and psychological tests. The LAPD, though, desperate to fill its ranks with black and brown officers, had let Perez slip through its increasingly loose screening process. Perez did his probationary stint in the LAPD's Harbor Division, then was transferred to patrol duty in Wilshire Division, where he first began to introduce himself as Ray. Driven and intense, Perez had a lithe body and a face that was remarkably handsome, except for eyebrows that grew in an almost solid line across the bridge of his nose. He advanced quickly within the LAPD, taking advantage of his fluency in Spanish to win an assignment as an undercover narcotics cop after only a year of patrol duty. The West Bureau Buy Team was made up of 8 to 10 younger officers who could convincingly pose as drug buyers in neighborhoods all over the city. While other members of the unit worked the beaches and busted Rastafarians, Ray Perez and David Mack accepted the most dangerous of duties, purchasing narcotics almost exclusively in notorious gang neighborhoods and housing projects. Like most members of the BI team, Perez loved the work. Just by its nature, there is constant danger, a constant go, 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 a constant rush. The detective who ran the BI team, Bobby Lutz, would explain to the Los Angeles Times. Those guys were on the edge all the time. They lap it up. They relish it. Russell Poole, like a lot of LAPD officers in more mainstream positions, regarded undercover narcotics officers as freelancers who made their own rules and regularly became untethered from such niceties as due process and probable cause. The worst of them were the best examples of how the war on drugs had ravaged law enforcement in the United States. There was a distinctly ends justify the means attitude that tended to blur the line between cops and criminals. Most undercover officers remained honest, but a lot didn't, believed Poole, who was convinced that both Ray Perez and David Mack had gone bad as members of the West Bureau BI team. During the first briefing I received on Mack, Poole recalled, I was told that he allegedly had been involved in several ripoffs of drug dealers, and since Perez was his partner, it seemed pretty likely that he had been involved also. In 1994, soon after David Mack left the BI team to transfer to West LA, Ray Perez applied for a job with the Chino Police Department. Everyone who knew about this was astonished when Perez didn't land the position. Ray's boss, Bobby Lutz, figuring the yokels out in Chino should consider themselves lucky to land a top LAPD officer, phoned the smaller police department to ask what was going on. When the Chino cops said they couldn't talk about it, Lutz surmised that Perez had failed a test, either a polygraph or a psychological exam. It was yet another red flag that no one chose to wave, and only a few months later, Ray Perez moved onward and upward to the Rampart Division's CRASH unit. CRASH, which stood for Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, was the LAPD's elite anti-gang unit. And Perez joined it at a time when the department estimated that Los Angeles was home to 403 distinct gangs, claiming nearly 60,000 members. In 1994, the year Perez joined CRASH, gang members committed almost 11,000 crimes in the city, by the LAPD's accounting, including 408 homicides. Gang violence had become the number one problem in most citywide citizen polls, and about 10% of all Los Angeles's gang crimes were occurring in the LAPD's Rampart Division patrol area, turf of the notorious 18th Street Gang. In the mid-1990s, Rampart Division covered 8 square miles of decaying apartment buildings and scabrous storefronts between Hollywood and downtown, encompassing the Pico, Union, and Westlake districts. These neighborhoods were the most densely populated in Los Angeles, and home to perhaps the highest percentage of illegal immigrants in the state. Vendors who peddled big sacks of oranges and dealers who sold small bags of cocaine worked the sidewalks side by side. Nannies and gardeners who sent half their minimum wage paychecks back across the border waited for buses all along the perimeter of MacArthur Park, which had become the largest open-air drug market in the United States. And most of that drug trade was controlled by the 18th Street Gang. The 18th Streeters were by far the biggest gang in a city that had become the nation's capital of gang activity, claiming as many as 20,000 members who were scattered in subgroups, or cliques, up and down the West Coast from Tijuana to Portland, Oregon. The gang wove together layers of criminal enterprise that deployed a system of tax collection to link drug trafficking all the way from the powerful, prison-based Mexican mafia at the top to the small-time independent dealers at the bottom. More than 150 murders were linked to the 18th Street Gang between 1985 and 1995. Citizens all across the city, and especially in the neighborhoods most affected, wanted the gang dealt with, and the members of Rampart's CRASH unit were on point in the LAPD's battle against the 18th Streeters, an engagement that would come to a climax in August of 1997 when the Los Angeles City Council won a court injunction against the gang that made it illegal for members to associate. In this context, joining CRASH during the mid-1990s was more like becoming a special forces fighter in a wartime army than anything resembling traditional police work. CRASH unit members were there to take back the streets, and an officer's performance was judged almost exclusively by how many gangsters he could put behind bars. Rampart's crash team had not only its own logo, the aces and eights of Wild Bill Hickok's Dead Man's Hand, but even its own headquarters in a detective substation a mile from the main division station. "We intimidate those who intimidate others," read the motto above the main entrance. Officers worked mostly at night and without any real supervision. If an officer made arrests that led to convictions, he was doing a good job. If not, he was considered to lack the initiative that anti-gang work required. Ray Perez had been a top producer as an undercover narcotics cop, and he continued to make a high number of arrests when he joined Rampart's crash unit. And perhaps no other detective on the LAPD could match his effectiveness as a witness in court. Public defender Tamar Toyster would recall her feeling of helplessness as she watched Perez testify against her client Javier Ovando in early 1997. It was a case where Toyster figured that both judge and jury might feel a certain sympathy for her client. Perez and his partner, Nino Durden, had shot Ovando three times in the process of arresting him, and the 19-year-old was left paralyzed from the waist down. Ovando had to be wheeled into court on a gurney at his preliminary hearing and would be confined to a wheelchair for the rest of his life. After Perez described how Ovando, whose gang nickname was Sniper, had attempted to ambush him and his partner with an assault rifle, though, the 18th Streeter's fate was sealed. "Perez was unbelievably good on the witness stand," Toyster recalled. "He was better than any police officer I've ever cross-examined. Smooth, sincere, articulate, with just the right amount of emotion. You couldn't bait him. You couldn't trip him up. You couldn't get him to react." Duly impressed, Judge Stephen Schuliger sentenced Ovando to 23 years in state prison, even more time than the prosecutor had asked for. "That was entirely due to how good Perez had been on the stand," Toyster recalled. "I have to admit, I believed him myself." By June of 1998, Ray Perez was the target of a special LAPD unit. Though later made famous in the local media as the Rampart Task Force, back then it was known simply as the Robbery Homicide Task Force, and its creation was largely a response to the detective work of Russell Poole. The connections that Russ Poole had made between the David Mack bank robbery and the Biggie Smalls murder, including the possibility that an LAPD officer or officers might be involved, were the origin of the task force, agreed Richard Rosenthal. The assistant district attorney's recollection was ironic, since by the time Rosenthal came aboard, Detective Poole viewed the task force more as the vehicle for a continuing cover-up rather than as a means for arriving at truth. During the last 2 weeks of May, Poole had engaged in a series of public confrontations over the handling of the Biggie Smalls case, first with Fred Miller, then with Lieutenant Pat Conmay, and finally with Captain Jim Tetreault. "I told Captain Tetreault, I've never seen anything like this," Poole recalls. "If you want the Biggie Smalls case solved, you've got to give it to me alone." Several days later, Poole found a hand-drawn cartoon on his desk showing a toilet and the plumbing pipes connected to it. The words, "You are here," were connected by an arrow to a turd lodged in the pipes. Poole recognized the handwriting as his partner's. 2 days later, Poole flew to Chicago to interview Kevin Lewis. While he was gone, another senior detective filed a complaint against him, alleging that Poole had been derelict in monitoring the autopsy of a Los Angeles Unified School District police officer who had been killed by a shotgun blast to the face. Poole's lieutenant ordered him transferred out of robbery homicide, then reversed himself when the complainant's partner backed Poole. "For the first time in months, I sort of had an upper hand," Poole recalled. "The lieutenant had made all these accusations against me without waiting to hear my side of the story, and now he was afraid I'd file a complaint against him." Poole had been under an administrative cloud since the previous December when the department had brought charges against him for the first time in his career as an LAPD detective. The incident seemed so inconsequential at the time that Poole hadn't realized how it might be used against him later. He and his wife had separated for 5 months at the end of 1997, mainly because Megan was fed up with her husband's devotion to his duties as a police officer. "Living with a homicide detective is tough," Poole admitted. "Getting calls in the middle of the night, working long hours and only coming home to catch a few hours of sleep, being so absorbed in a case that you don't see what's happening in your personal life. I felt, look, it's a major responsibility to be a homicide detective. There's killers on the loose, and it's my job to find them. My wife wanted me to put my family first, and she was right, but I didn't see it at the time. While separated from Megan, Poole began dating a secretary who worked for the Los Angeles Police Commission. 10 days before Christmas, the pair attended a robbery-homicide division holiday party at Little Pedro's, a downtown restaurant favored by the LAPD. "All of us coppers drove our take-home cars," recalled Poole. "The woman I was dating and I only stayed about 45 minutes. I was exhausted. I'd been up for almost 2 days, with maybe 3 hours sleep in that time, and I had to get up early the next morning to fly back east. I didn't even have a drink. All I could think about was getting up at 4 the next morning." When they left the restaurant, Poole asked the young woman to drive while he took a nap. When she said yes, he kissed her on the cheek, then rolled over against the passenger side door and fell asleep. What Poole didn't realize was that his car was being tailed by an LAPD commander who would file a complaint against him for taking a department-owned car to the restaurant, permitting a civilian employee to drive it, and kissing her on the cheek in public. "When I went on vacation the week before Christmas, I figured I was facing the lightest slap on the wrist they could give me," Poole recalled. "For one thing, there were at least 24 other police vehicles in the parking lot of that restaurant, most of them driven by people of higher rank. Over the holidays, Poole reconciled with his wife and moved back into the family home. He came back to work in January feeling rejuvenated and was startled to learn that he faced a disciplinary hearing. I expected the captain and lieutenant to go to bat for me and say this is chicken shit," Poole recalled. "All the RHD detectives drove their take-home cars to places they shouldn't. Bars, golf courses, whatever. I didn't even know what the rules were because they were so loose. My supervisors were aware the parking lot of that restaurant had been filled with cop cars. I wasn't going to roll over on anybody, but they all knew." The investigation continued, however, and Poole knew by March that he would receive suspension days. "I couldn't comprehend that they were spending so much time and effort to make a case against me for such a trivial thing, when they had all these guys working for death row who were walking time bombs in terms of bad publicity for the LAPD. I felt like it was the ultimate disrespect to me and all the other honest cops in the department." Poole eventually concluded that his supervisors wanted leverage. "What the LAPD brass does to detectives working downtown is wait for you to make a mistake, then let you know that they've got you by the balls," Poole explained. "The message is, you will do as we say or we'll use this against you. When they think they have you under control, they put you in a position where you can be helpful." The detectives assigned to the Robbery Homicide Task Force in the spring of 1998, Poole would observe, included one who had been caught using the word nigger over the radio and another who had been accused of beating his wife. Poole's lieutenant, meanwhile, had attempted for months to bait him into filing a complaint against Fred Miller for dereliction of duty. "Conmay would come to me and ask where Fred was," Poole recalled. "My answer was always the same. I don't know where he is now, Lieutenant, but I can page him for you." I could see the frustration in Conmay's eyes. He was hoping I would tell him Fred was on the golf course. But I wasn't going down that road. I knew the veterans would crucify a snitch. When the LAPD brought him up on charges for misuse of his take-home car, they thought they had me, Poole recalled. "It really pissed them off when I admitted what I did, signed the papers, and took my suspension days. I wasn't going to let them hold it over me." Poole's colleagues in RHD were sympathetic at first, but as word spread that he was trying to make a case against cops in the Biggie Smalls murder investigation, many of his fellow detectives began to observe that Mr. Goody Two-Shoes had feet of clay. "There were a lot of innuendos of a sexual nature because the woman I'd been dating was in the car with me," Poole recalled, "and that was painful because I was back with my wife and wanted to put that whole period of my personal life behind me. And the guys who were still on my side were keeping quiet, waiting to see how this whole thing would play out. So I felt more and more isolated." After the first attempt to oust him from the robbery homicide failed, Poole's supervisors realized that having him around put them at risk. "So they got me out of RHD by offering me a more prestigious assignment," Poole recalled. "Captain Tetreault came to me and said, 'Russ, how would you like to join the task force and be in charge of Biggie Smalls and the connections to Mac in the bank robbery?' I said, 'I'd love to, but am I going to have some power and leeway to do this right?' I told the brass that time was of the essence because once Suge Knight went to jail, it was a perfect cover for the cops involved to get out of the organization. They promised I would have the power to get all the subpoenas I needed, but almost as soon as I joined the task force, they told me I was off the Smalls case. Fred Miller was embarrassed and had insisted that the Biggie Smalls murder investigation belonged to him, Poole was informed. So now the brass wants me to concentrate on Perez, Poole recalled. When we were first forming the task force, the main targets were supposed to be David Mack and any other police officers who might be involved in either the bank robbery or the Biggie Smalls case. And Perez was sort of an afterthought. That's what they said, and that's what they wrote, but it was all bogus. They wanted that on the record as the official intent, but once we started, they completely abandoned David Mack and Kevin Gaines and Biggie Smalls and the whole Death Row Records investigation. We didn't work on anything else but Perez. It was like the whole thing got transformed overnight. I knew it was coming down from the top, but nobody ever told me why we were doing what we were doing. I had to figure it out on my own. The other members of the task force also seemed uncertain about the parameters of their investigation. Just how large a criminal conspiracy were they dealing with, detectives wondered. Perez and Durden and Sam Martin were meeting for lunch every day, Poole recalled. Then they'd reconnoiter in the middle of the night in Griffith Park behind a urinal stall. We didn't know if they were talking about the bank robbery, the stolen coke, the Biggie Smalls murder, or all three. By the time Poole joined the task force, detectives working the coke theft case realized that Perez had for some time been taking advantage of the LAPD's absurdly lax system for checking out drugs as court evidence, especially when the amounts involved were a pound or less. Essentially, all an officer had to do was make a phone call to the property division, give his last name and badge number, then ask that the dope be sent to him by courier. The drugs had to be returned, of course, but no one at property division ever checked to find out if what they got back was pure cocaine or a bag of baking powder. How much coke Perez had stolen remained in question, but there was little doubt he was supplying a significant number of street dealers. During July of 1998, while still under surveillance, Perez was photographed in a romantic embrace with a juicy-looking Honduran nightclub singer he knew as Bella Rios. Her real name was Veronica Quesada. Poole and another task force detective were assigned to watch the woman's apartment, wait until she was alone, then ambush her with a request for an interview. Veronica Quesada knows English, but she wouldn't speak to us, Poole recalled. She kept saying, "No comprende." She hung tough during questioning. She's no easy mark, I can tell you that. Quesada's composure dissolved, however, when her brother Carlos Romero walked into the apartment carrying a quarter pound of cocaine. The brother was so dumbfounded that he just stood there, Poole remembered. It might have been the easiest coke bust in history. During a subsequent search of the apartment, the detectives opened a drawer in the living room console and discovered a framed photograph of Ray Perez wearing a blood-red sweatsuit and flashing the West Coast gang sign. "I remember thinking I knew it," Poole recalled. Within a couple of weeks, detectives from the task force had established numerous links between Perez, Quesada, and Romero. The most significant of these was that both Quesada and Romero had been convicted of felonies during the past year for dealing cocaine, yet each had received a suspended sentence. In both instances, this was because the judges who heard the cases received requests for leniency from the estimable detective Ray Perez. At the time of her arrest in April of 1997, detectives learned Quesada was in possession of pay O sheets bearing the initials RP and the phone number for the Rampart Division. And on the date that the 2 kilos of cocaine were checked out of the LAPD's property division, supposedly by Officer Joel Perez, Ray Perez had made a total of 8 phone calls to Veronica Quesada and Carlos Romero. The detective made more than 160 calls to the same numbers between November of 1997 and June of 1998. When questioned, Perez explained both his requests for leniency and the phone calls by claiming that Quesada was a former informant with whom he had unfortunately become sexually involved. "The guy was cool under questioning," Poole recalled, "but when I saw him one afternoon soon after that at the police academy, you could tell he was scared shitless. He was looking around all the time, over his shoulders, behind his back. He knew we were closing in on him." By the time of the drug bust in Veronica Quesada's apartment, Russell Poole had become convinced that the main intent of the task force created by LAPD Chief Bernard Parks was not to expand the investigation, but to limit it as completely as possible. First, Chief Parks wanted us, me, to drop everything pertaining to Biggie Smalls, Kevin Gaines, David Mack, and Death Row Records, and to concentrate on Perez, Poole recalled. But then it turns out that we're not supposed to look very deep into Perez's background either. I was starting to get the feeling that this entire investigation was going to end up as nothing more than a coke bust. On his own initiative, Poole read through more than 100 reports written by Ray Perez in connection to drug arrests the detective had made. It's like this guy is Superman, Poole recalled, like he has X-ray vision or something, because he's making all these fantastic busts and dope seizures where he seems to see through walls. Again and again, Poole noted, Perez would report that suspects had signed consent to search forms. He had all these dope dealers telling him where their stash was even before they confessed, Poole recalled. That never happens. You bust a dealer, they figure, fuck you, find the shit yourself. And every one of these reports was the same. They were like boilerplates where you just fill in a new name and date. Any veteran cop would look at them and know they were fake, because any veteran cop knows that no case is identical to any other. Poole took the reports directly to LAPD Commander Dan Schatz. He called them suspect, but wouldn't add falsifying police reports to the charges against Perez, Poole recalls. That was when I first began to realize that the main objective of the task force was to protect the higher-ups, starting with Chief Parks. At almost the moment he began to think in this vein, Poole's supervisors reduced his role in the Perez investigation so that he could concentrate on an incident involving another member of the Rampart crash unit. This was Brian Hewitt, who had been accused of viciously beating 18th Street gang member Ismael Jimenez during an interrogation. On February 26, 1998, Hewitt and his partner, Daniel Lujan, had picked up Jimenez and his friend, Eduardo Hernandez, in front of a tattoo parlor and detained the pair on suspicion of grand theft auto. The real reason the two were transported to the Rampart detective's office, though, was most likely the complaint of excessive force filed by Hernandez's mother against two other Rampart officers. Both Jimenez and Hernandez said they were taunted and threatened by Hewitt, who, after separating the pair, demanded that Jimenez find me a gun, lead him to an 18th Street gang member he could arrest for illegal possession of a firearm. When he refused, Jimenez said, Hewitt grabbed him by the throat and forced him backward until his head struck a wall. You're not fucking hearing me, Hewitt told him, according to Jimenez, whose hands were cuffed behind his back. I will book you for anything. You had better tell me tonight where I could find a gun. When Jimenez didn't answer, the powerfully built Hewitt punched him with a clenched fist several times in the chest and once in the kidneys. All I want is one little gun, Hewitt said, then turned and walked out of the room. A few seconds later, Jimenez vomited blood on the carpeted floor and nearly passed out. When Rampart officer Ethan Cohen walked into the interview room a few moments later, Jimenez told him he couldn't breathe and had vomited blood, then pleaded with Cohen to remove his handcuffs. Cohen looked at the bloodstain on the floor, said, oh shit, then quickly turned and left. Cohen came and went twice more, Jimenez said, before finally removing the cuffs and telling him he was free to leave. He vomited repeatedly during the mile and a half walk back to the tattoo parlor, Jimenez said, where friends told him he looked really bad and drove him to Good Samaritan Hospital. Doctors in the hospital's emergency room reported the alleged assault to Rampart Division's watch commander, who sent a sergeant to take Jimenez's statement. A scrap of carpet was collected as evidence, and the case was turned over to Internal Affairs, which basically did nothing for the next 5 months, said Poole. The detective was startled to discover that the IA investigators had not even ordered DNA testing of the blood on the carpet. All that takes is one phone call, Poole explained. I made that call as soon as I found out that they hadn't checked to make sure the blood belonged to Jimenez. And it turned out, of course, that it was Jimenez's blood. One claim after another made by the gangbanger and his friends checked out. At the same time, Poole heard troubling descriptions of Officer Hewitt's violent disposition. It became clear pretty fast that Hewitt really liked beating people up, Poole recalled. He got off on it, almost in a sexual way. Though he didn't quite comprehend it at the time, Poole's investigation of Hewitt would mark a major turning point in the task force's mission. Up to that point, all of the officers under investigation were suspected of murder, robbery, or drug dealing. The case against Hewitt, though, was for brutality. It seemed very strange and mysterious when they moved me over to the Hewitt case, Poole recalled. First, I was going to go after Mack and Gaines and all the cops who were suspect in the Biggie Smalls case. Then I was supposed to work the dope case against Perez, and the next thing I know, they have me on the Jimenez beating. I kept wondering, what is this about? Then they partnered me with an investigator from Internal Affairs. I asked the lieutenant, isn't this a conflict of interest? I mean, I was supposed to be investigating criminal charges, and she was supposed to be investigating administrative ones. But the lieutenant said, no, you're both members of the task force. I said, okay. But then they assigned the very detective who had tried to run me out of RHD with those bullshit charges about the autopsy to supervise the investigation. And right away, he accuses me of trying to fabricate a case against Hewitt. Poole went to the task force leader, Lieutenant Emmanuel Hernandez, and asked him to assign a new supervisor to the case. Hernandez, however, refused, even after I told him that the guy's attitude was going to screw the case up if it ever went to court, Poole recalled. What I didn't realize then was that Chief Parks didn't want this case to go to court because the brass were still trying to cover up an earlier investigation involving Hewitt and Perez that they should have used to clean up Rampart Division way back in September of 1995. In that case, Hewitt, Perez, and a female officer named Stephanie Barr were accused of criminal retaliation against three 18th Street gang members suspected of slashing the tires on Hewitt's vehicle. After an entire squad of cops beat the three gangbangers senseless, Hewitt, Perez, and Barr stripped them down to their boxer shorts, the 18th Streeters said, and made them walk nearly naked through a crowd made up largely of young women their own age. Actually, only two of them walked. The third, 19-year-old Carlos Oliva, was in a wheelchair, paralyzed from the waist down by a shooting 4 years earlier. Thoroughly humiliated and feeling he had nothing left to lose, Oliva filed a complaint the next day. The man who took that report was Lieutenant Emmanuel Hernandez, then a Rampart supervisor. Nothing much happened until December, when Oliva was arrested for allegedly driving a stolen car. Though released after 5 days on that charge, Oliva was rearrested a month later by Barr and Hewitt, charged this time with possessing 55 rocks of crack cocaine for sale. Mainly due to the good work of his public defender, the case against Oliva was shown to be badly flawed and probably dirty. His arrest kept Oliva behind bars for 3 months, however, until the district attorney's office reduced the charges against him from a felony carrying a sentence of 5 years in state prison to a simple possession misdemeanor that allowed Oliva to avoid prison by entering a drug diversion program. Oliva's complaint against officers Hewitt, Barr, and Perez, meanwhile, was now being handled by the Internal Affairs Division under the control of then-Deputy Chief Bernard Parks. Internal Affairs moved the Oliva investigation along as slowly as was humanly possible, not even bothering to interview the alleged victim until 8 months after he had filed his complaint. In the meantime, the young man who had joined Oliva in the complaint was turned over to the Immigration and Naturalization Service by a group of LAPD officers that included Hewitt and Perez, then deported to Honduras. Not until late 1997, almost 2 years after the original incident, did Internal Affairs officers file a report recommending that several officers, including Brian Hewitt and Stephanie Barr, be given letters of reprimand, a slap on the wrist that did not even delay Barr's promotion to homicide detective. Ray Perez was not disciplined at all for his part in the incident. That whole, quote, investigation, unquote, was about letting the statute of limitations run out so that no charges could be filed and the thing could be kept from the public, Poole said, and that's how they wanted the Jimenez beating handled. It came to the task force originally in order to protect Parks from any connection to the Oliva thing. The IA investigator they partnered me with and I were supposed to put together a case that would let them fire Hewitt from the department and bury the whole thing internally. Only I thought criminal charges should be filed. So pressure was constantly being applied to back off. But I wasn't going to back off, and when they saw that I hadn't learned my lesson, they thought, oh no, we have a real problem here. I figured, yes, you do. Chapter 10. Russell Poole wasn't the LAPD's choice to be the officer who arrested Ray Perez, but the department continued to place the detective in the right place at the wrong time. Poole and a female narcotics investigator named Diana Smith were assigned to perform surveillance on Perez's house in Ladera Heights on the morning of August 25, 1998, shortly after the department's brass decided it was time finally to charge the crash detective with grand theft. We were sitting out front when we saw the garage door come up, Poole recalled. Denise Perez, his wife, backs her BMW out and leaves for work. SWAT is supposed to make the arrest, and an hour later they're working their way toward us, but on the radio we hear that our cover may have been blown. One of the chiefs had ordered that Denise Perez be pulled aside at work and asked if her husband is at home. That tips her off. She goes back to her cubbyhole and calls home. Ray Perez comes out a few minutes later, climbs into his red Ford Expedition, and takes off. We catch up and follow. Diana is driving. I call in a request for an air unit and backup because we're going to pull him over. We're going north on La Brea by now. We pull up next to the Expedition. I point and hold up my badge. Perez gets this wild look in his eyes for a moment, and I think maybe this is going to turn into a pursuit or even a shootout, but then he pulls over to the curb just as the air unit and a black and white show up. I take Perez over to my car and put my cuffs on him. I can see his heart literally pounding through his shirt, but he won't make a sound. That's when I notice the briefcase in his vehicle and ask what it's for. He says, that's for my lawyer. I was on my way to my lawyer's office. He's a cop, so he knows he has at least a legal argument to suppress if we open the briefcase and find evidence against him. I wanted to open it anyway, but when I phoned the DA, Rosenthal, he says no. It was a stupid mistake, but Rosenthal ended up making a lot of stupid mistakes, and Perez wouldn't say another word. For Poole, his arrest of Ray Perez was considerably less significant than his role as evidence coordinator during the search of Perez's home 19 days earlier. The search had produced a trove of 228 suspicious items stashed in nooks and crannies all over the house. In terms of the drug theft, perhaps the strongest evidence was a carton of papers that included receipts for thousands of dollars in cash deposits to a Wells Fargo bank account, records of large purchases on an array of credit cards, documents related to the purchase of real estate in Puerto Rico and California, 8 pages of cellular phone records, plus assorted phone and address books. Poole was most interested, however, in the 59 items recovered from cardboard boxes in the basement of the house. These included not only hundreds of rounds of live ammunition that ranged from 12-gauge shotgun shells to 22-caliber rifle bullets, but a large assortment of folding knives and a perplexing collection of replica firearms that included an Uzi air gun, a .357 Colt Python with a plugged barrel, several realistic-looking cap guns, one with a screw-in silencer, as well as 9mm and .38-caliber models. These plastic weapons were stage props and children's toys, but they looked convincing in photographs, and Poole believed, correctly, that this was their purpose. It turned out that Perez and his buddies were planting them on suspects, Poole explained, taking photographs at the scene and using those as evidence in court. Perez had cached a huge quantity of stuff stolen from the LAPD, including nearly 24 keys to police vehicles, several raid jackets, and 3 crowd control helmets. What caught Poole's attention, though, were the police scanners Perez kept concealed in his basement. Since starting on the Biggie Smalls case, I had kept coming across these crime reports in which the perpetrators used police radios and scanners, Poole recalled. Mark Anthony Bell said Suge Knight and his thugs had used them to monitor the cops while they had him locked in that room upstairs. And the USC student said he had heard Mac and the other 2 bank robbers listening to police scanners. There were all these reports of the death row people using them in and around their studios in Tarzana. Perez certainly didn't need them for framing suspects, and there was no evidence he used them in his dope dealing. For me, this was a possible link to Mac and to Death Row, but once again, I couldn't get anyone interested in pursuing it.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade finished up the first audio segment. We are in chapter 10. That's what we'll pick up at for audio segment number 2. The number to dial, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Alrighty. Let's see. Try and figure out, do I want to do my audio presentation now? Wait. I will wait. We have one more audio presentation for today, but I will wait. I'll give one email, and then we'll get to some of the folks who dialed in with commentary. I posted an email for the interview with Davey D, Randall Sullivan, Russell Poole. We started the broadcast out today, so you can hear it in its entirety. Again, Davey D, victim of white supremacy and longtime journalist, radio host, lots of great work with Hard Knock Radio down in California, unless I am mistaken. Southern California, no less, but man, listening to that interview, like, wow, white people can clown a lot. Particularly if we are not suspicious and really thinking like, wow, I might be talking to a race soldier here who has an ulterior objective. Anywho, first person wrote in, one of our investors. I looked at the movie City of Lies. I think the movie clearly implies that David Mack was involved or directly murdered Christopher Wallace. Towards the end of the movie, in the garage scene, it shows the posters of Tupac in Mac's garage, which has been variously described as a shrine to the artist. We heard that today. Chapter 9. He married a young enlisted woman from the nearby Peace Air Force Base. Lori Charles was black and assumed, based upon his features and complexion, that Raphael was also. It was an early example of Perez's remarkable capacity for shape-shifting, especially along racial and ethnic lines. Not sure what the author meant by this. His wife didn't know that he had Puerto Rican ethnicity? Question. That does not seem credible. Number 2. What made this remarkable was that Perez already had applied to and rejected by several smaller police departments in Southern California after failing background checks and psychological tests. I suspect those smaller departments were in communities that were mostly white. LAPD may have just looked the other way during the screening process. Now, that is an interesting theory. Which communities were saying, oh, wait, nah, we don't want this Perez guy? 3. CRASH, which stood for Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums. Remember, there's a movie by the same name that came out at the same time, which also features a rogue Negro cop who is selling drugs and all the rest, who gets shot and killed by a white officer. And then they go and make up some nonsense to try to hide that this is some rogue Negro officer so that they can say, hey, we got this white guy. He's a bad dude and he shot this guy and is a no count, no good Nick. And they lie and make up all this because they say we need a black hero. That's not what happened in this case at all. Not even close. But that's that no count filth trash. Ludicrous. Lorenz Tate. Remember that? Sandra, the great Sandra Bullock, the blind. That was even before The Blind Side. That was before Bird Box. Before Blind Side, there was Crash. Let's see. Oh, I didn't read the rest of it. So three, CRASH, which stood for Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, was the LAPD's elite anti-gang unit, and Perez joined it. This sounds pejorative to me. Amen. Dehumanizing black males, the man not hoodlums. Like, really? Hoodlums. Gangbanger, hoodlum, all that, you can substitute nigger. Number four, it became or becomes clear pretty fast that Hewitt really liked beating people up. Poole recalled he got off on it almost in a sexual way. I could not tell from the text whether Hewitt was white or non-white. I was saying the same thing, but I said he's got to be black because we haven't heard any sort of indictment like this of a white person in the text, not even David Kenner. So I will look to see if we can get an image of Mr. Hewitt, but I'm like 1,000% certain. And particularly, this is, we're talking about someone getting off sexually on beating people up. Didn't we hear about this in the last book? I mean, really, didn't we just read this? Geronimo Pratt, ooh, his penis got erect. It's like he enjoyed beating on, abusing, bludgeoning other black people. Like he got some sort of sexual didn't we hear that? That's exactly what I've quoted Julius Butler repeatedly when we've been reading this, right? We're supposed to link all three of these, right? We just heard that. So I either have to think like, wow, is there like before the Rona, was there some sort of infection where circa 1995, like after O.J. Simpson, like, whoo, or I guess Geronimo Pratt, this was before, but something about black males in Southern California, they get some sort of, what do they call it, sadomasochistic enjoyment out of beating other black people. I guess I could think that, or I could think, wow, maybe that's just one of the running lies in the system of white supremacy when we really are going to stick it to a Negro. Like, oh, yeah, the Negro. See, his penis jumped. We could see his penis through his britches. We knew he enjoyed beating on the Negro. That's the end of chapter 9. The rest of it is chapter 10. We'll get to that later. Yeah, we'll get to that later. Number again, 720-716-7300, decode 564-943-pound. The other thing that I'll say I forgot, and I thought this was so important from the audio we started with, Randall Sullivan, Russell Poole, when they talked about the Kevin Gaines shooting, he was the black male killed by Frank Leica, a white male, and they say that Kevin Gaines pointed this gun at Frank Leica. There's no allegedly. It's not like we got witnesses. We don't have video. Unless I'm mistaken, the only person to testify, oh, yeah, we saw him pointing a gun at Frank Leica, was Frank Leica. It's not like you had tons of witnesses and video that, oh, yeah, I saw him pull a gun out at this brother. Like, since that's not the case, it should be allegedly. And even if it was the case where you had a witness, you didn't have a trial, he wasn't convicted, like, allegedly, very important word that will be conveniently left out when talking to black people. You are convicted. Like, we don't have to have no trial, like, nothing. Negro convicted. Let's see if folks who dialed in have thoughts, observations. They would like to chime in. Let's see. Henry in Chicago, nabbed by the folks as we see them.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. The author, I guess, say he's going to do this in every chapter. I don't know. Putting up Russell Poole's performance records as it's supposed to be some, you know, level of credibility of Russell Poole. And, you know, it sounds more like kind of like a court case where, you know, you got to, you know, prop up the witness as a credible witness, you know, so your case could be made. I don't know, that maybe that's what he's doing with Russell Poole's performance records. I mean, me personally, I wouldn't care one bit about, you know, his excellent performance reviews. He's still a race soldier, and he still can practice racism. Perez's remarkable capacity for shape-shifting, especially along racial lines, and this is when the author was talking about Perez's early years dating some non-white black woman, and it you know, this thing of what he's calling shape-shifting. Like, I didn't realize, you know, non-white black people or non-white people can shape-shift, whatever that means. But also, too, I kind of feel like with his implication of him dating this black woman, that he's putting Perez squarely on, you know, as a non-white black person. And this book seems to be on the attack of, you know, non-white black police officers as the culprits, you know, the main people of the Rampart scandal. So this is what he's, for me, this is what he's kind of like trying to categorize Perez as, not as a Puerto Rican, you know, but as a black person, a black male. He says the war on drugs had ravaged law enforcement in the United States. According to my numbers, the biggest victims of the war on drugs have been black people, whether they be in jail or whether they've been, you know, whether they're dead or murdered. I don't find a lot of police officers who claim to be victims of the war on drugs. Matter of fact, they are the perpetrators of it. They are the enforcers of this war on drugs or war on black people or war on poverty or whatever, you know, war that this government wants to claim on non-white people. Crash had his own headquarters. Kind of reminds me of the Holman Square torture site created by none other than Chicago police officer Commander John Birch. I'm pretty sure the Crash headquarters was something similar to the Holman Square facility that was here in Chicago. When he talked about Perez with a romantic embrace with Veronica Quesada, and it's interesting because he has a romantic embrace in quotes. I don't know if it's to emphasize it, you know, or whatever he's trying to do when he puts it in quotes, but he kind of like emphasizes that. But yet, in when the author's talking about Russell Poole and his interaction with his, you know, female friend and, you know, innocent little kiss on the cheek, he kind of minimizes that, but yet he maximizes this romantic embrace that Perez has. And one more thing, I still have yet to have the author give me concrete, hardcore evidence that Mac, Death Row Records, have been implicated in the Notorious Big's murder. Just a bunch of speculations, a bunch of black police officers who aren't supposed to be doing what they're supposed to be doing or associating with Death Row. Or drug dealers, whatever, but none of this has, for me, has yet tied into the Notorious Big's murder. Maybe he might say it later, but as of yet, we are roughly about halfway through the book, and I still haven't found any hardcore evidence of it. So that's all for me. I'm in my line.
He said no evidence. My man Davey D, victims guaranteed qualify, said it's an open and shut case. David Mack killed Notorious B.I.G. But I mean, he did say exactly open and shut case. I said my jaw was on the ground like, what? What? What book are you reading? Are you reading Labyrinth? Randall? Maybe he's reading a different book than we are. Maybe they got footnotes or something
in the addition that maybe he and Randy, because he called him Randy, maybe he and Randy are tight. So he got the footnote version of this text. So, you know, he is straight. Everything he got is verified. I'm so thankful, before we get to some of the other folks, I'm so thankful Henry in Chicago brought up the point about many of these parts. The book is like sectioned. There's chapters too, but sections. They start with like a paragraph or so from Russell Poole's performance evaluation about what a swell fella he is. Like, let me see one of these here. Poole has performed his duties in an outstanding manner. He is a dependable, hardworking, and loyal employee. And it goes on. Like, I could see maybe if you do one of these, okay, and then you move on to something else. But like, every single section, we got to remind. Do you know Russell Poole is the greatest, most hardworking, efficient law enforcement officer Southern California has ever seen? Let me tell you again. Henry in Chicago, he said, man, it's like you got to prop up a witness here. Like, this guy is lame. We got to really polish him up and get some elbow grease here. And ooh-wee. Thank you so much, because I felt like, what in the world? I'm just going to ask, open-ended, like, what do people think is up with this? Like, why do we keep having to read this? Like, is he going to get to the point at some point where it starts to go downhill with, like, this Russell Poole fella is the lamest officer ever. How did he get hired? He's lame and incompetent. Like, is he going to do that in that manner? Are we just going to keep getting what they call glowing reviews? Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, *61. Let's see. I think Rob used to be Rob in Wisconsin. Now Rob in the same Southern California.
Brady, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I tuned in kind of late, so I didn't hear the beginning of the first audio session, or I didn't hear the audio clip that you played before the audio session got started. But when I did tone in, maybe about 30 minutes into the broadcast, and my observation was kind of that in the same of Henry in Chicago. I was wondering, I guess I can state it in a question, is the book written by Randy Sullivan and Jordan Poole? I mean, not Jordan Poole, the pool officer?
No, the credit is just Randall Sullivan, and I guess he had access to Mr. Poole and maybe some of his investigative materials, but the book credit is just Randall Sullivan.
Okay, because the way that chapter read to me, it sounded like Mr. Poole was the narrator in that chapter, and was just kind of asking myself the question, like, why is the, unless it was him himself, like, why is the author really, like, highlighting his work performance and, like, how good of an officer he's doing? And another observation that I had is, like, the author is making this Poole detective thing just like a knight in shining armor. Like, he just always want to do the right thing, and, you know, he's the one getting to run around and, you know, this and that. And it seemed like a little bit much, like you, like, really just trying to prop this guy up. And that's my observations for the first audio segment. Thank you for listening.
Much obliged, Rob in Southern California, propping this fella up, Russell Poole. That's an interesting observation about the perspective. I would definitely agree with that. The perspective of the book is that of Russell Poole, the officer, like what he's going through. And even he is the victim here. Like, you know, they're not listening to him and pushing him out of the investigation and got him by the balls and all the rest of it. Poor old Russell Poole. I said we had other audio segments, so before I get to some of my notes. So the interview continues. This is Davey D., victim of white supremacy, and Russell Poole, Randall Sullivan, Hard Knock Radio. It continues. They're talking about Suge Knight now. I think it was last week. My memory might be off about the week, but I think recently Henry in Chicago said, it was last week. He said, man, we are really taking it easy in this book on David Kenner. You know, we're not going to go too hard on him and all of his gangster connections and how much power he has at death row and him being the brains of all that. We're going to go kind of light on all that. Listen to this segment where they're talking about Suge Knight. And man, I'm like, this interview is about 55 minutes and I almost got to the 40 minute mark. So I'm more than 2/3 of the way through the interview. I haven't heard David Kenner's name mentioned one time. Didn't get mentioned in the section of the book we read this week either. But listen to this here segment, Suge Knight, Powerful Negro.
So, but what it is that...
Why weren't they allowed to work for Death Row Records?
Because Death Row Records was considered to be a criminal organization. I mean, Suge Knight, as you know, has a long criminal record, and a lot of the people connected most directly with Suge Knight have long criminal records and of major criminal violence.
Suge's entourage was constructed of the Blood gang members in Los Angeles. Suge Knight was a very powerful individual. What made him powerful, he had access to just about the entire Blood gang, and he also had dozens of police officers in his back pocket. He also had a district attorney in his back pocket who was actually handling one of his probation cases. He also he had connections with the Compton mayor, and I have a picture of Suge Knight and Mayor Reardon embracing each other. So he had access also to Maxine Waters, and there's a lot of she's a councilwoman in Los Angeles, and she actually stopped a narcotic federal probe in Texas involving her husband's best friend, and actually stopped midway through the investigation.
Context of white supremacy, again, no mention of David Kenner. So Suge Knight is this big, bad, powerful Negro who can do whatever he wants because he's got Maxine Waters, who, you know, we heard how Donald Trump talked about her. President Donald Trump talked about her. There we go. He's got all these Bloods, and boy, he is the biggest, roughest, toughest, rootinest, tootinest Negro male in the known universe. Now, wait a minute. That's not what Randy Sullivan said in the book. Randy Sullivan, in the book, he said, Suge seemed to believe he could get away with just about anything, more than a few observers said, especially since the appearance of Maxine Waters. And that's not what Randy Sullivan said in the book. Let's try it again. Suge seemed to believe he could get away with just about anything more than a few observers said, especially since the appearance of the Crips. And that's not it. Bloods, and that's not it. What he wrote was, Suge seemed to believe he could get away with just about anything more than a few observers said, especially since the appearance of David Kenner at his side. That's what he wrote. That's what I said, like, wow, did David D. read the same book we read? Victims Guaranteed Qualified. I'm just saying, it does not sound like, woof, woof. But even I continue, because I listened, I said, really? Let me continue, because the notes that I took, the most important notes that I took in the text, let me scroll down a little bit further. David Kenner was the brains of the company, that being Death Row Records, Hackey said. And it was common knowledge at Death Row that the attorney provided connection to the organized crime families back east. Lots of that, how he formed the company. How do we have this conversation about all this power that Suge Knight had and he could do whatever he wanted with impunity? And this white man's name doesn't come up. And this is a white man with connections to what they call organized crime. His name doesn't come up. That's what I mean, system of racism. If we have a system of racism, white supremacy, all that to talk, Suge Knight is the most greatest thug in the history of the music industry. And that cannot be if we're in a system of white supremacy. All of the thugs are classified as white. You're just talking about victims beating up on other victims. Lots of that. And white people show you better than I can tell you. When they got ready to lock Suge Knight up, Suge Knight was locked up. It was not, oh my God, what are we going to do? Where are we going to go? He's got weapons of mass destruction. Mustard gas. Who knows? What are we going to... Let's go get that Negro. And they did. Got pictures of him and David Kenner. David Kenner probably wearing some sort of custom-made tailor suit. Suge Knight in an orange jumpsuit. Jumpsuit. And they say he's the greatest thug ever. Get out of here. Let's see. Notes for Chapter 9. Get away from my... One more. This case is so rife, or I guess it's multiple cases, at least with the murders of Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls. It's like, I can't even say logic. There's so much nonsense. The racism is there. White people just lying and no evidence. And, well, the streets said, you know, it was said out in the alley that, you know, that type of nonsense is rife. But there are people who serious. We heard some of it in this book. Hey, you know, Notorious B.I.G., he wrote a song bragging about shooting Tupac Shakur in 1994. Who shot you? There are versions of this song. One of the original versions features Keith Murray. Remember him? Most beautiful thing in the world. Is Keith Murray an accomplice in the 1994 shooting of Tupac Shakur? I never heard anyone say that, but I mean, he is on the song. Did they tell him, like, hey, this is my secret diss record where I admit my complicity in the shooting of Tupac Shakur, and we want you to be on the track with us, Brother Keith? Like, do what? Like, why involve Brother Keith in all this? Like, come on. All that is absolute nonsense. It's childish. It makes absolutely zero sense. I mean, to this day, like 25 years later, you have so-called grown adults who are supposed to be using a brain computer where this will be like the basis of their theory about what happened. Whew. Strive for logic. Racists have been extraordinarily successful. Books like this are a part of the confusion. Chapter 9. All right, so we get to Perez. There's lots of information on Rafael Perez. He changed his name, and I was correct last week. I said it. They don't have a Wikipedia page for David Kenner, but guess what, though? They got a Wikipedia page for Rafael Perez. Now, you're going to tell me that they made all of this effort? We want to look out for the brother, the Puerto Rican brothers and the black brothers, Kevin Gaines, who was shot and killed. But we want to look out for brother Kevin Gaines. We don't want all this bad publicity on their name. What are you talking about? Like, Rafael Perez is like known. When people think of rogue, dirty cop for LAPD, it's Rafael Perez and Mark Furman. Those are like the only two names. Maybe Kevin Gaines and David Mack might follow, but that's it. I don't think there are any other white officers that people think of. Like, they've done such a astounding job with marketing books like this. So if the theory is that former LAPD chief of police Bernard Parks, black male victim of racism, that he and maybe other black leaders, maybe Congresswoman Maxine Waters, I don't know, she and maybe some others, maybe the Nation of Islam, they all conspired in this to make sure that these black officers' names were not besmirched. They failed. And Kevin Gaines is still dead. Let's see. Perez's remarkable capacity for shape-shifting. I generally hear that sort of language, shape-shifting, used when talking about aliens. I will say that I've heard it used more in terms of conversation about racism, white supremacy. Generally, it'll be talking about a racially ambiguous person and their ability to maybe be classified as white sometimes, maybe classified as non-white, but not too much. I have heard it a few times there. But generally, I hear this term used in a pejorative way, as was stated, and talking about non-humans. Generally, non-white people, the man not people, the fungibility, right? That's Dr. Curry. You can just kind of make them whatever you want for your racist white supremacist purposes. Let's see. And there's something sexually perverted about black males. It seems we've got that throughout. Perez gets some sort of sexual gratification from beating black people. Oh, that was Annette. Sorry, I think that was one of the others. But Perez, and he's got this sexual infidelity. He's cheating on his wife. The sexual misdeeds of the Negro male and his penis, O.J. Simpson. Let's see. We heard that about Geronimo Pratt. I just said that's three in a row. Three in a row. Let's see. The man not. So CRASH, I just said, which stood for the Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums. What is it? NAACP was niggers, apes, alligators, coons, and possums. Here we go. In this context, joining CRASH during the mid-1990s was more like becoming a special forces fighter in a wartime army than anything resembling traditional police works. Like, wow. Now, he gives the whole context. This connects to the Mexican mafia, which was trying to kill Geronimo Pratt in prison, we heard. Like, what? Like, hearing this now, this book published right at the beginning of the 2000s, 2001, I believe. Like, wow. I can totally understand how we've had the whole quarter century of lots of black males, especially, beat, crashed, beaten, caged, lied upon. I can totally understand. Let's see. CRASH unit members were there to take back the streets. An officer's performance was judged almost exclusively by how many gangsters. That's another one where I said you can remove gangbanger, any of those other gangsters, niggers, he could put behind bars. Rampart's CRASH team had not only its own logo, the aces and eights of the Wild Bill Hickok's Dead Man's Hand, the symbolism there for Dr. Welsing, but even his own headquarters in a detective substation a mile from the main division station, the resources that they can devote to keeping the Negro male in line, staggering. Let's see. I've talked about names in the book. They said Ovando, who is one of the victims, allegedly, of Ray Perez, his nickname was Sniper. Just the names of these non-humans, non-white people. Let's see. I thought that's a great comparison when they talking about the incident where Randall Sullivan was followed and he had a civilian in the vehicle with him and the police chose to make a big deal out of this, and they make this such a quaint, innocent event in comparison to the way that they talk about Perez and the black male who's he gets some sort of sexual gratification, you know, from mauling other non-white people. Excellent contrast. Let's see. The detectives assigned to the Robbery Homicide Task Force in the spring of 1998, Poole would observe, included one who had been caught using the word nigger over the radio and another who had been accused of beating his wife. And he says this in the context of, hey, they get you over the balls. They get you in a position where they know they have something on you so that you will be more easy, or you will be more readily compliant. Toe the line, as they say. You know, you said nigger and we got you, so you better behave. I would think lots of people would be in trouble because it seems like there's lots of racism, white supremacy, LAPD, policing in general. Let's see. Word Nick, does that pop up? Even the inclusion of that, I'd said before, because we said nigger was every other sentence, right, in the first 2-3 weeks of the book, and we haven't heard it a whole lot. This is one of the few times. Like, that's an odd anecdote to have it included. Like, again, I say the same thing. Randall Sullivan strikes me as someone who enjoys saying the word and probably watches minstrel shows, right? Because he said Notorious B.I.G. looks like something out of a minstrel show. You can't make that statement and say that, hey, I'm ignorant about racism and I can be real specific. You can't make that comparison metaphor and be ignorant about minstrel shows. I don't know what book Davey D read, but I'd have had a very different set of questions for Randy. Let's see. By the time Poole joined the task force, detectives working the coke theft
case realized that Perez had for some time been taking advantage of the LAPD's absurdly loose system for checking out drugs as court evidence, especially when the amounts involved were a pound or less. All I can say here is this is 3 years after the O.J. Simpson debacle. Now, if they take the position, which he did clearly earlier in the text, O.J. Simpson guilty. Negro male killed these white folks. Okay, part of that was really poor work by the LAPD, their criminologists. That was a part of this rubbish. Bad evidence collecting, right? Let's clean that up. You got 3 years. It should be sparkling like this should be the definition of professional law enforcement. You're not even keeping track of drugs. I thought we got wartime activity. You're going out busting people. Three strikes and you're out of here. Not going to tolerate this anymore. You're not even keeping track. You go out bust people to get the drugs off the street and then go right back and give it again. And you're not going to tell me that old Rafael Perez was the only officer engaged in this. Get out of here. It was just these nigger males. Get out of here. Let's see. During a subsequent search of the apartment, the detectives opened a drawer in the living room console and discovered a framed photograph of Ray Perez wearing a blood red sweatsuit and flashing the West Coast gang sign. I remember thinking, I knew it, Pooh recalled. I don't know what you knew. You would have to give me more than that. And somebody putting up a dub like the Nation of Islam is a gang. That's something that I learned from this book. I didn't know that before. Apparently, a number of white people, racists, they just think Nation of Islam, gang. I knew a lot of people, just a lot of white people, black person, gangster, gangbanger. Nigga, I already thought that, but wow, Nation of Islam, gang. Got it. Okay. This one, throwing up a W, gang, black person, gang. Don't they just do that in videos? Being a gang. Let's see. Bernard Parks, one of the higher-ups, he said in that clip that it was black leaders pushing racial politics that concealed what happened in these cases. So apparently, former LAPD chief Bernard Parks, black male, was a part of that, and then going out and recruiting nigger male athletes who went to USC. It seems David Kenner had some USC connections too, not just O.J. Simpson. Anything else? Chapter 9. One claim after another made by the gangbanger nigger and his friends checked out. At the same time, Poole heard troubling descriptions of Officer Hewitt's violent disposition. It became clear pretty fast that Hewitt was a sadist. Poole recalled he really liked beating people up. He got off on it almost in a sexual way. What in the world? Like, even time out. Like, all right, Officer Poole, what evidence do you have that Officer Hewitt, Brian Hewitt, who had, and I looked, I couldn't find an image, so I think this is a black, I don't think they'd be talking about a white guy like this, but I could be wrong. We heard this about Geronimo Pratt. I think this is a black guy. Right at the genital level, Bill Cosby. I think this is a black person, but I could be wrong. I'll see if anybody can find Brian Hewitt, H-E-W-I-T-T, if you can find information to see, is this a white person or non-white person? I think it's a non-white person. Either way, what evidence do you have, Mr. Poole? And even, are you qualified to make such an evaluation? Is that in your pay grade? Like, you can look at evidence and determine, oh yeah, this person is committing this. They're getting some sort of sexual gratification out of these beatings. And I've studied this where? Have you investigated these type of cases? Do it. Same thing we said throughout the book. Where's the evidence that there was some sort of sexual gratification or motivation possibly in these beatings? I do know white people have a history of that sort of thing. That's like the whole hit. That's why I'm saying I think Hewitt is a black male, because that is a core part of white history. Focusing on black genitalia, I was going to go back to the whole lynching thing and castration and all that, but nah. I'm going to do right on for 2021. They're celebrating the 50-year anniversary of Shaft. You shouldn't think of Richard Roundtree or Samuel L. Jackson when you think of Shaft, or even the late John Singleton.
you should think of Tidy Man. That's his name. Is it Eric? I'll make sure I get his first name, but it's because I looked up, I was like, what kind of name is that? Shaft is the creation of the white mind and the homoerotic creation of the white mind. Earl Tidyman, that's his name. Earl Tidyman. That's white culture, focusing on the genitalia of black males and deriving some sort of sexual gratification from beating and genital mutilation of black males, black people in general sometimes. That is a big part of white culture where they bragged about this. That is not black culture. In fact, I'm not aware of that being non-white culture anywhere else in the world, to derive sexual gratification from beating people. Maybe I'm in error. Let's see. After an entire squad of cops beat three gangbang niggers senseless, Hewitt Perez and Bart. See, the way that he's, this is not a white man. Let's put $50 down. Like, we put some money. This is not a white man. They would not be talking about Mark Furman like this. This is some non-white person. Maybe it's a black person or whatever, but this is not a white man. Hewitt, Perez, and Barr stripped them down to their boxers. And see, I don't even believe this. You don't have a footnote for this. Maybe this happened. Maybe it didn't. But I mean, we are right back to the same thing. The man, not some sort of sexual whatever's going on here. Like, ooh, and there's a newspaper report with this one I was just looking at about this incident where Officer Hewitt ended up being fired and all that. People can go check it out, get more details. I'll check it out. But after an entire squad of cops beat the three gangbangers, niggers, senseless, Hewitt, Perez, and Barr stripped them down to their boxer shorts, the 18th Streeters said, even that, non-white people, and made them walk nearly naked through a crowd made up largely of young women their own age. One paralyzed was in a wheelchair. The man, not Dr. Curry, talked about that as well. And that's the end of chapter 9. I did take other notes from the beginning, very beginning part of chapter 10. We got this wild eye. This has been a pattern throughout. We got wild-eyed black people and these just really bizarre descriptions of black people. In the last book, they said that McCloskey, he went into one of these black neighborhoods, and I guess he had on red or blue or whatever the incorrect color was. And they said his eyes, the black woman saw him, and her eyes went as large as pancakes. I've never in my life seen anyone with eyes as large as pancakes. I don't know what type of pancakes they make in your part of the world, but my eyes, nor do any other eyeballs that I've seen, resemble pancakes in size. This time around, the first page of chapter 10, he says, Diana is driving. I call in a request for an air unit and backup. This is Poole talking, because we are going to pull him over. We're going north on La Brea by now, but we pull over next to the expedition. I point and hold up my badge. Perez gets this wild look in his eyes for a moment, and I think maybe this is going to turn into a pursuit or even a shootout. A wild look. The Negro is always some wild animal, savage. And wild-eyed Negro. See, we got the reckless eyeballing. And it's always the Negro eyes. See, the eyes are like pancakes, you know. So, Right. Anything else that I took in the first part? I think I'm good. Awesome. I'll double-check. Anything else folks need to get in before we push off to audio segment number 2? Mo in Dallas, do you have commentary, sir? You should be with us.
Yes, sir, I do. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, Smith and Carly. Thank you for the program, Gus. Well, you mentioned Shaft. As it pertained to the detectives, and I just pulled the theme song on. So I'd like to read the first line from the theme song. Who's the black private dick that's the sex machine to all the chicks? Shaft. You damn right. I found that you bringing it up interesting, simply because the you know, that was about a black detective that was kind of taking it to the man, if you will, and it was manufactured by non-black white supremacists, if you will. And I find it interesting just to understand, like, a black male being employed, you know, being an enforcement official in any capacity, he's entering into, like, uncharted territory, you know, and he's very uninformed of the environment that he's in. So if there is something like stealing going on by these officers, you know, by these black officers, with drugs or whatever, and things like that, they have to be shown how to do these things by someone. You understand? Like, and usually, like, in my mind, yeah, maybe I'm a conspiracy theorist, but I don't see the black person being hired in a police station and not being heavily monitored, because niggers steal, don't they? You know, leave the cocaine with the niggers. You know, it just doesn't make logical sense for it to go on like that without it being condoned in some capacity, unless that's a part of the environment. Because as a black male, I feel like, and this is just my feelings, that would be an uncomfortable environment to be in to just commit crimes. But I could be in error. As far as the detaining the Afro Latino officer and the look in his eyes, that line stuck out to me simply because I was talking to male victims earlier today, and we were talking about how we're not allowed to look confused. If a black male, in my opinion, in my experience, looks legitimately confused, like it looks like an angry face. You know, it looks like an hostile face to whoever is seeing the face, whoever is experiencing your confusion on the opposite side. And it's very easy, and it's happened to me a couple of times recently, to where I was confused and the person that confused me assumed I was being hostile, assumed I had a fiery look in my eyes, assumed I. And it's very difficult to express emotions when people in your environment assume that any time that there's a misunderstanding, you're angry. And that makes it very hard to communicate. And it also gives black males, in my opinion, a stigmatism of being angry without understanding what exactly it is that they are feeling. So the man not. Thank you. I mute my line.
Much obliged, Mo in Dallas. Shaft should be coming to the book club. I tried to see if we can get Mel to narrate for us. I'm hoping we might even be able to go back to back and do Earl Tidyman Shaft, where he is explicitly engaged in anti-sexual behavior in the novel. Sex machine, indeed. Sex machine, see, man not, machine. But we might even be able to go back to back with Woody Allen's autobiography, where he talks about his love of raping children, Sun Yi, and Shaft. Woo! Sexual perversion in the system of white supremacy. But yes, I am super excited about the 50-year anniversary of Shaft. Any other commentary on this first section of Labyrinth before we get to audio segment two?
I have one thing. I was thinking about that word shape-shifting in regards to it. And, you know, I was looking up shape-shifting in regards to, you know, myth and folklore and just basic literature. And it seems like the common theme of shape-shifting is basically kind of deception, you know. So, you know, with words being very important, you know, I'm wondering, you know, if he's, you know, he's basically using that word to describe Perez as, you know, very deceptive in, you know, in his nature and character. So But that's all I have of him in my life.
Absolutely. Something mischievous, untrustworthy about him. You know, you can't even rely on his racial classification being the same. Like, you really got to watch this guy. Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Anyone else? Grant, we will assume folks are satisfied for the time being. If you have additional comments, just jot it down, notes, what have you. We should have time to share. Once the second audio segment concludes, we are in chapter 10. We are closing in on the end. We should have like max two more sessions to go. Try and slow things down and, you know, really dig in for details on the last few bits of the text here. But Randall Sullivan's Labyrinth, no footnotes, no references, lots of anti-blackness. We shall proceed. Context of white supremacy, audio segment number 2.
Shortly before the search of the Perez residence, Fred Miller had responded to increased pressure to make something happen in the Biggie Smalls murder investigation and Silence Pool by orchestrating a series of raids on the offices of Death Row Records production companies and on assorted homes and businesses owned by Suge Knight. A fishing expedition, Suge Knight's latest attorney, Robin Yanez, called it, and Russell Poole agreed. "I warned everyone that was the wrong way to go," Poole recalled. "To get to a guy like Knight, you have to go from the bottom up, and the cops who worked for him were the best way to do that. Those guys were the weak link, and I think a lot of them would have rolled over if they'd been brought up on charges, criminal charges especially. I've seen it before. Once these guys are in the court system and know they're facing prison time, they will talk. Cops understand better than anybody that once arrests are made, it becomes a race to see who can cut a deal first. But all those raids accomplished was to make everyone scatter. The LAPD trumpeted its seizure of an Impala SS owned by Suge Knight and let the news media know that forensics tests had turned up gunshot residue around the driver's side door. But that SS was red, not black, and the gunshot residue had been found nearly a year and a half after the Biggie Smalls shooting." Poole's refusal to abandon his interest in the Biggie Smalls murder was making his position on the task force, and his assignment to the Robbery Homicide Division as well, increasingly untenable. "I was complaining that we had had a series of incomplete investigations and that it was orchestrated to be that way," Poole explained. "I had become convinced that LAPD officers affiliated with Death Row Records had been involved in the conspiracy to kill Biggie Smalls, and none of the brass wanted to hear that." It didn't help that Poole persisted in pushing the investigation toward even more untested theories of police involvement. When he learned that the bloody clothing and shell casings that the prosecution considered its most important physical evidence in the murder case against Snoop Dogg had been either lost, stolen, or discarded while in LAPD custody, Poole inquired as to where those items had been held. He was informed that they had gone from West LA to Pacific Division before disappearing. "David Mack was at West L.A., and Kevin Gaines was at Pacific," Poole observed. "I know from my own experience that virtually any police officer can gain access to evidence held in the property room at an LAPD station, and that they have access to the computers that can be used to authorize destruction of evidence also. I thought it should be looked into, but no one would even talk to me about it." Poole also was intrigued when Brian Tyndall told him that one of the first people to communicate with David Mack after he was arrested for the bank robbery was the flamboyant racing and rock concert promoter Mike Goodwin. The note Goodwin sent to Mack at the Montebello City Jail read simply, "If you need anything, give us a jingle." What made those words interesting was that Goodwin for years had been the prime suspect in one of LA's most famous unsolved murders, the 1989 slaying of the legendary race driver and former world land speed record holder Mickey Thompson. Thompson had been shot to death in his driveway in what LAPD detectives described as an assassination by professional hitmen. A number of witnesses had seen the suspects fleeing on bicycles from Thompson's secluded home in the hillside community of Bradbury and identified the pair as black males in their mid to late 20s. When Poole ordered up the composite drawings that had been made of the suspects, he decided that they looked a lot like David Mack and Amir Muhammad, who were 28 and 29 years old at the time. Descriptions of the suspects' heights and weights also matched Mack and Muhammad. I was reaching, obviously, Poole conceded, but then that's how cases get solved. Again, he could not initiate an investigation. I heard one more time that I didn't have sufficient probable cause, Poole recalled. But how could I get that probable cause without authorization to investigate? It was the same catch-22 logic they had been using to block me all the way back to the Kevin Gaines investigation. Of course, I couldn't demonstrate that Mack and Billups, Muhammad, had been Mickey Thompson's killers, but I felt certain there was a legitimate basis for looking into that possibility. Nobody in the upper echelons of the LAPD wanted to hear it, though. The climax of Poole's tenure with the task force came 1 month later when he was summoned to a September meeting attended by Lieutenant Hernandez and Chief Parks. The meeting was awkward from the start and became actually uncomfortable when Brian Tyndall brought up the Biggie Smalls case. I had been told by Hernandez in advance not to say a word about Biggie Smalls or Mack and Gaines, Poole recalled. But near the end of the meeting, Tyndall says, Chief, Russ still believes Mack had something to do with the Biggie Smalls case. Tyndall didn't have to do that, and it took some balls, but he really believed deep in his heart in what I had to say, and he's a very good cop, so he spoke up. But Parks just clammed up. He wouldn't say a word, wouldn't even look at anybody. It was like Tyndall hadn't spoken. It was very bizarre. And then a few minutes later, the meeting was over. When Parks finally spoke to me, all he said was, I don't want you to investigate anymore. Give me a report in 2 weeks. The report Poole turned in was on time, but hardly what Chief Parks had hoped for. Only a short time earlier, Poole had submitted his chronology of the Biggie Smalls murder investigation. 31 pages long and extremely detailed, it made a persuasive case that the LAPD had failed to pursue its best leads, dating all the way back to the implication of Kevin Gaines. Poole argued strenuously that David Mack should be considered a prime suspect in the murder, and that Mack's relationship with Ray Perez was perhaps the most important, unexplored territory touched upon by the investigation. The involvement of LAPD officers with both Suge Knight and the Bloods gang was not speculation, Poole insisted, but a fact that had been demonstrated overwhelmingly by evidence that the department had been sitting on for more than 3 years. Even though he had been listed for 15 months as the lead investigator of Biggie Smalls' slaying, Poole's chronology was rejected by his superiors and never included in the murder book that was the LAPD's official record of the investigation. The report he delivered to Chief Parks in early October of 1998, 40 pages long, single-spaced, and barely margined, picked up right where his chronology had left off, however. Combined, the two documents laid out an investigation that began with the Gaines-Liga shooting, passed through the Biggie Smalls' murder and the Ray Perez dope bust, and culminated in his investigation of the Ismael Jimenez beating. What they described was a contamination of the LAPD that had spread from a crew of black cops affiliated with Death Row Records into the Rampart crash unit. Hernandez was furious, Poole recalled. He tells me, we can't use this. The chief doesn't want this stuff in there. Poole's 40-page report was edited to 2 pages by Hernandez, who put his own name on it before sending it to the district attorney's office. They also purged most of the supporting documents I had given them, Poole recalled. The DA's office still doesn't know what was kept from them. The Los Angeles Times published the first substantial media account of Ray Perez's arrest on August 29, 1998. Officer's arrest triggers corruption probe, read the headline. From Poole's perspective, that sounded promising. It soon became obvious to the detective, though, that the Times knew only what Chief Parks wanted it to know, and that the rest of the media in Los Angeles either followed the city's one daily newspaper or reacted to it. LAPD detectives were focusing on several officers who worked with Perez, according to the Times' unnamed source, and were interviewing both former and recent partners of the accused detective in an effort to determine whether there are other dirty cops on the force, the newspaper reported. The only other suspects named in the article, however, were Veronica Quesada and Carlos Romero, while a careful reading of the story made it clear that the probe would be focused on alleged drug dealing by officers assigned to the Rampart Division. Also evident upon careful inspection was that the Times had depended upon a single source, identified in the article as a police official close to the investigation. Although it could never be confirmed, rumors spread among both members of the news media and local government officials that the Times source was Bernard Parks. Little of substance was added during the next several months of news coverage. There was no mention in the Times of David Mack or Ray Perez's alleged involvement with Death Row Records. Perez was Rafael Antonio Perez in newspaper accounts of his arrest, and none of the city's media informed their readers, viewers, or listeners that the officers who were the focus of the investigation, David Mack, Sammy Martin, and Nino Durden, were all black. The Times did not report either that prior to the theft of 2 kilos of cocaine he was charged with, Perez had stolen a pound of coke that had been checked into evidence by Frank Liga. And while Detective Liga claimed to have been told by Brian Tyndall that the wiretap placed on Perez's residence between August 2nd and August 11th strongly suggested that the pound of cocaine had been targeted as payback for the death of Kevin Gaines, no mention even that the wiretaps existed was made by the Los Angeles media. In November, Deputy District Attorney Richard Rosenthal filed court papers explaining that he would not introduce the wiretap tapes as evidence at trial, meaning that they would never become public information. Chief Parks described the arrest of Perez as sad and tragic, while the accused officer's own attorney, Johnny Cochran protege Winston K. McKesson, told reporters his client was shattered by the charges against him. The story soon faded to such insignificance that when Perez's first trial ended on December 23, 1998, with the jury hung, the Times story ran on the fourth page of an inside section. The case had been rushed to trial over the assistant DA's objections, according to Richard Rosenthal. "I wanted to wait for the financials on Perez," the prosecutor explained, "but LAPD was anxious to get things over." Chief Parks and virtually everyone associated with the robbery-homicide task force understood what a disaster it would be for the department if the investigation that had led to the arrest of Ray Perez was closely examined by the local media. And Winston McKesson had at least an inkling. "This case has made everybody in the LAPD nervous," Perez's attorney remarked to the Times. "Nobody wants to be associated with this." McKesson, born and raised in South Central Los Angeles, cut quite a contrast in court as compared to Rosenthal, a UC Berkeley grad in his mid-30s who was best known in the DA's office as a whip-smart wonk skilled at crunching numbers and making cases out of circumstantial evidence. Rosenthal had absolutely no street smarts, though, Russell Poole would observe, and that's what made him so wrong for this case. The media later would accuse him of botching the prosecution of Perez, but Rosenthal insisted, "Our case went well." Still, the prosecutor allowed, "It was a downtown jury, and Perez was a good-looking, likable guy of mixed ancestry, and he testified very well. I believed he was lying through his teeth, but he did it very convincingly." Perez lied so convincingly that 4 members of the jury, all black or Hispanic women, voted to acquit him. "That hung jury changed the whole outlook of the investigation," Russell Poole recalled. "Parks wanted this thing over by the end of the year, but when they lost that first trial, the chief panicked, thinking, 'Oh shit, what are people going to think now? We got to do something fast.' So they started pushing to make a deal with Perez." What pushed Perez was that his potential prison sentence increased each time a new count was added. And new counts were being added on a regular basis after the task force began testing the drug packages returned to Property Division to see if the cocaine inside had been replaced with something else. Almost immediately, investigators found several quarter-pound packages that had been switched. "We would have found more," Rosenthal said, "except that a lot of the smaller drug packages had been destroyed." Also, Rosenthal now knew that Perez's bank records showed unexplained deposits of $49,000 in cash during the same period the missing cocaine was checked out. Now facing as much as 12 years in state prison, Perez gave McKesson permission to negotiate a deal in May of 1999. Rosenthal's best offer was a 5-year prison sentence in exchange for full disclosure. The prosecutor added the condition that Perez submit to a polygraph examination and that the results could be admitted in court at his sentencing hearing. The prosecutor also asked for a proffer of Perez's testimony. "We sat down together at the counsel table in the courtroom," Rosenthal recalled, "and Perez told me, 'I was involved in a use of force that may or may not have been unlawful, but what was unlawful was that we planted a gun on the guy afterward.' The next day, Rosenthal and his team went through every shooting case involving Perez, and we knew right away that it was the Javier Ovando case he had been talking about, the prosecutor recalled. Rosenthal spent nearly all of that Friday with Perez, who admitted that Ovando had been unarmed when he and his partner Durden shot the gangbanger, and that they had planted the assault rifle on him to cover up their mistake. LAPD detectives interviewed Ovando in state prison over the weekend, and on Monday, Rosenthal filed to free Ovando with the first writ of habeas corpus ever obtained by a California prosecutor. The day after that, Rosenthal sat down again with Perez, who understood that simply admitting to one terrible crime that he and his partner had committed made him as far from sympathetic as possible. So his time gave the prosecutor a list of Rampart officers he said were in the loop. That is, willing to frame gangbangers with manufactured evidence and then to perjure themselves in court. By the time Perez finished talking, his confession was 50 hours and 2,000 transcript pages long. More than 70 of his fellow officers had been implicated in crimes that included shooting unarmed suspects, planting guns or drugs on them, and beating gangbangers senseless with clubs, fists, and feet. Perez described how one gangbanger was used as a human battering ram until his head punched through a wall, and how another was hung from a fire escape by his ankles until he talked. He and other Rampart crash officers routinely picked up gangbangers they thought might give them a problem and delivered them to the INS for deportation, said Perez. Only one incident truly haunted him, though, Perez said, and that was the shooting of Javier Ovando. He and his partner Durden were on stakeout inside a vacant apartment in a building on South Lake Street that was a known hangout for 18th Street gang members, Perez recalled, looking for a cache of weapons that had been stolen from a residence in Orange County. They had been lying in wait for about 3 hours when Durden heard footsteps and the two of them turned toward the apartment door just as Ovando opened it and stepped inside. Durden immediately opened fire, hitting Ovando 3 times. Perez shot the gangbanger once himself, he said, then helped Durden plant a sawed-off rifle on Ovando and concocted the story that the critically wounded man had attempted to ambush the two detectives. Perez also accused an East Indian officer named Kulin Patel of accidentally shooting an unarmed man during the raid of an apartment building on Chateau Place, recalling that he and his fellow officers arrived at the building in a commandeered gypsy cab with tinted windows that let them drive right up to the front door without being spotted by the gangbangers inside. When Brian Hewitt and his partner Doyle Stepp planted a gun on the dead man, Perez said, nobody said a word. Rampart Crash maintained its own organized system for covering up crimes by police officers, one quarterbacked by Sergeant Edward Ortiz, according to Perez, who told Rosenthal that officers could join the loop only if they were sponsored by someone already inside. Officers who were in the loop received playing card plaques whenever they shot somebody. A red deuce if the suspect lived, and a black deuce if he died, said Perez, who claimed to have been rewarded with a 2 of hearts for crippling Javier Ovando. Though he insisted it was sheer torture to rat out men who had trusted him, no one was more heavily implicated by Perez than his own partner. While Brian Hewitt was brutal, Nino Durden was vicious, Perez said, the kind of guy who thought it was amusing to spray pepper mace into the eyes of a passed-out drunk or shoot a cornered suspect in the mouth with a beanbag shotgun. Durden once outed an informant in front of his fellow gang members, Perez recalled, chuckling later as he imagined what they must have done to the snitch. Durden could be slick, though, Perez said. Once Nino bought a mailman's uniform and used it to bluff his way past a group of paranoid crack dealers he wanted to rip off. It was Durden who first talked him into stealing drug money, Perez said. In March of 1997, they made an undercover buy from a dealer at the corner of 2nd and Serrano, Perez recalled, then seized $1,500 from the guy after his arrest. Durden palmed $1,000 of that and gave Perez half. That summer, the two of them busted a bunch of people who were cooking up crack in the Wilshire division, Perez said. Back at Rampart Station, a pager belonging to one of the dealers went off, and he and Nino set up a sale, supposedly to arrest the guy. When they arrived at the meet, though, Durden said, screw it, let's just sell it to him. He totally agreed, Perez recalled, and eventually went in with Durden on 2 more coke sales to the same person, all from a stash they kept in an igloo cooler that sat in a corner of the cot room at Rampart Station. They cleared $5,000 apiece. Perez rambled on and on, recalling how one officer chugged a pint of vodka at the Rampart crew's crash pad apartment in the valley, then vomited off the balcony onto the head of an older woman who lived downstairs, transitioning from that into a description of how Sergeant Ortiz had used a piece of chrome fender to cover for a female officer who fired at an unarmed man. Perez came across as entirely forthcoming about his own career as a drug dealer. Except for the 3 kilos that had led to his detection, all of the cocaine he stole from Property Division was delivered to him by courier at Rampart Station, Perez said. He had replaced all of that courier dope with Bisquick, except for the pound checked into evidence by Frank Liga, said Perez, who claimed that in this one instance he ditched his return package because he thought he was being followed. The 3 kilos he was afraid to ask for by courier, Rosenthal recalled. Also, they might have tested an amount that large. He neither believed nor disbelieved Perez, Rosenthal said. I learned from the trial not to judge Perez by his demeanor, the prosecutor explained. I don't know when people are lying, and Perez is an exceptionally good liar. He was still waiting to see the results of the polygraph tests, Rosenthal recalled. Russell Poole was aghast when he learned that the DA's office had cut a deal with Perez. My hunch had been proven right, but I was devastated, Poole said, because I knew we could have taken care of it cleanly if they just let me do what was right. We didn't need to make a deal with Perez, who should have been sent to prison for the rest of his life. The whole investigation was flowing toward some grand conclusion that was going to tie it all together. At least that's what I believed. But as soon as they made the deal with Perez, it was like he became in charge. He decided what parts of the investigation were going to stay alive and which weren't. Perez had implicated almost every detective he worked with at Rampart Station, Poole noted, yet insisted Sammy Martin was clean. The same Martin who was meeting with Perez and Durden in the dead of night once they knew there was an investigation, Poole observed. Even more dubious was Perez's insistence that he knew of no criminal activity by David Mack. Chief Parks himself would tell the media that he believed Perez was not telling the whole truth about Mack. Because the inquiry into Perez's activities had become so vast, Rosenthal decided to conduct 5 separate polygraph examinations of the disgraced detective. The last 2 would focus on Perez's relationship with David Mack and on other shootings not disclosed by Perez. Perez submitted to the series of lie detector tests on separate days between November 30th and December 16th, 1999. Rosenthal received the results on December 19th. 2 days before Perez was to face sentencing. The timing was no small problem for the prosecutor because Perez had failed all 5 of the polygraph examinations that he took. It was very disturbing news, Rosenthal admitted. Frankly, my feeling had been that even if Perez lied, he would pass the polys because he was such a good liar at trial, and I never dreamed he would fail all 5. The prosecutor promptly won a 2-month delay of Perez's sentencing hearing and spent much of that time searching for a polygrapher who would explain how Perez could fail all 5 polygraph exams and still be telling the truth. He eventually found a professor in Minnesota who said the polygrapher who administered the 5 exams had made a crucial mistake during the first session by springing a question on Perez that he wasn't expecting. And that could have screwed up the other polys, Rosenthal explained, because Perez felt he couldn't trust the polygrapher. Rosenthal declined, however, to ask that Perez submit to examination by a different polygrapher. I felt that Perez would have a built-in excuse if he failed again, the prosecutor explained. Perez would have failed again, said Russell Poole, so it was easier just to say the first polygrapher fucked up and give Perez his deal. Perez would do 5 years, less time served, for the cocaine thefts, Judge Robert J. Perry ruled, and received immunity for all other crimes to which he had confessed. This meant that, with time off for good behavior, Perez could be a free man again before the end of 2002. Perez's statement at his sentencing hearing on February 25, 2000, would be published by newspapers around the world. It was a model of contrition that began with the disgraced cop's admission that nothing he could say would be strong enough or genuine enough to warrant my pardon. The atrocities he and other officers in his crash unit had committed, Perez Perez told the court, were the result of an us-against-them ethos that allowed those in the loop to believe we were doing the wrong things for the right reasons. At the end of his statement, Perez quoted the mottos that were posted above the entrances to the LAPD's crash units, then said he would like to add one of his own. Whoever chases monsters should see to it that in the process, he does not become a monster himself. Most of the spectators in the courtroom looked moved, and a few wept openly. Among those closest to the investigation, however, there was a palpable sense of unease. Perez had been just as convincing, they all knew, and every bit as emotive when he perjured himself at trial after trial during the past several years. This was the best liar they'd ever seen in a courtroom, both prosecutors and defense attorneys agreed, and yet the vast legal web in which they found themselves caught had been woven with little more than his word. While Perez tearfully apologized for what he had done to Javier Ovando and insisted his guilt about it had driven him to confess, those who had been in court when Ovando was sentenced to state prison recalled that the detective's immediate response back then was a snicker. No one is ever going to know for sure how much of what Perez said is true and how much is made up, Russell Poole observed. Just like we'll never know how much he revealed and how much he kept to himself. The guy is like some human two-way mirror. He can see out, but we can't see in.
Ray Perez, my goodness. Worst fella in the history of life. Context of white supremacy. We have probably two sessions left. We'll slow down and really dig in the last 2 weeks, get our concluding thoughts together, and maybe we can get some more interviews from Russell, Randall Sullivan and Russell Poole before we wrap things up. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. I will check the phone lines. We have some folks who wrote in as well. Let's see. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, a line should be open. I'll check in with you all first if you have commentary, and then I'll get our emails, get my thoughts, and we'll wrap up for this Thursday. Folks who are with us, Rob in California, Henry in Chicago, Mo in Dallas, other folks, any thoughts from audio segment 2?
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago.
All right. It seems like in this session, the author was, I guess, finally, as I've been thinking, that, you know, Poole's investigation is just kind of like, you know, theories and no concrete evidence, you know. And one of the statements he made, I had become convinced that the LAPD officers affiliated with Death Row had been involved in the conspiracy to kill Biggie Smalls. And then the author was like, you know, he had said that Poole was actually reaching. Well, I mean, that's something that I've been seeing like all through this book. Like, you know, he has no concrete evidence of any of these officers being connected to the Biggie Smalls case, much less, you know, just a couple of, you know, witnesses, well, not witnesses, but kind of like snitches in county or, you know, non-credible witnesses that, you know, said they saw some black guys with some bow ties and a suit, you know, and it just, you know, it's just speculation. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to see it pop up now where it's like, you know, we've all been questioning all along, where is the hard evidence? It's kind of like, you know, and I'm glad you made the connection to the O.J. Simpson case. You know, where is the hardcore evidence? You know, is there a murder weapon? Are there credible eyewitnesses? Did the suspect admit to the murder? Was there actual video of, you know, these people murdering the suspect? I mean, none of that is there. And that's the only hardcore evidence you have. And convicting a murderer. So, and then this line where they were talking about the Perez case and the he was talking about the hung jury and how it, four members of the jury, all black and Hispanic women, voted to acquit him. And it's interesting how he stated that that Perez lied so convincingly to these to this jury, to the those specific people in the jury that they voted to acquit him. Now, it's kind of very familiar of what Jeffrey Toobin mentioned with the OJ jurors and how they were incapable of seeing justice in the case. So that's why they, you know, acquitted OJ, because, you know, OJ was black. So, you know, he was okay. And black people can't determine, you know, justice. All they can determine is race. And it, this kind of seems kind of similar, but that's all I have on my line.
Henry in Chicago bringing up that old Jeffrey Toobin, who, since we started our whole study on L.A. beginning with O.J. Simpson, Jeffrey Toobin got fired from The New Yorker, a long vacation from CNN, and now he's back. White people don't get fired, they get transferred. Sometimes they just get long paid, what do they call it, sabbaticals. Yes. And they said the same thing. Yep, we got Rob in Southern California. Didn't they say the same thing about the Orenthal James jurors? Black females, eight black females, ten non-white people in total. They said, yeah, that handsome, charismatic Orenthal James and that old slick-talking Johnny Cochran. And his, you know, his wiles, he'd get up there and talk to those black females and they would just swoon over that Johnny Cochran and that no good O.J. Simpson. You put that good. And he said the same thing about Perez. That's what Henry in Chicago said. You put that old good looking shape shifting Rafael Perez up there, and the same effect. They just get up there and swoon. And ooh, that black male. And ooh, they can't even think straight. Innocent. Doesn't matter about the evidence. Heard this before. Rob in Southern California. Yes, sir.
Greetings. This second audio segment to me read like he was highlighting the wrongdoing of the black officers. He made it seem like that it was only black officers involved in the illegal activity at a crash. And in my opinion, all of that wouldn't have been going on if somebody white wasn't at the forefront of it. Also, the situation in the courtroom also stood out to me, particularly saying like he's the best liar that the courtroom has ever seen, and then just making it seem like, oh, the black male looks so good that, you know, the black female is just incapable of controlling herself. And, you know, kind of like that courtroom part read to me like a subtle attack on the black male and female hypersexual stereotype. And I think that's about it. And I'm in my line. Thank you.
Indeed. I thought that was a particularly repulsive section. Again, we just had former LAPD officer Brian S. Bentley on the program a little more than a week ago. And he said, hey, we were trained to lie. You lie in the report. You lie before you go on the witness stand. In fact, he said some of the LA attorneys that they had to work with, prosecuting attorneys, were the best. Like, oh, no. Don't say that you couldn't see what it was. Uh-oh, fire department. Shout to retired firefighter. That's Seattle, Seattle's finest, they say. Seattle Fire Department. All those reckless fireworks, see? They still got all the debris left over that they didn't use all of it. So that's probably what it is, alcohol and fireworks. Bad combination. Anywho, but yeah, Mr. Bentley, former LAPD officer, he said we were trained a lot. And the LA prosecuting attorneys taught us how to refine our deception. Right. He said, if you go and you arrest someone and you say, well, I saw an object fall and I thought it could be a gun. He said, you saw a gun fall from his pocket. And that's the way you write it down. He said, but I didn't see a gun. You saw a gun fall from his pocket. Saw a gun fall from his pocket. He said that in the archives. He said that. And I mean, not that I needed to hear that. Mark Furman. We read Orenthal James, Jeffrey Toobin, Mark Furman. We know this. Matter of fact, don't just put it all on Mark Furman. They sit around and act like that was great police work. Didn't they say they lied, Orenthal James? They lied on the search warrant. They lied about hopping over the fence. They lied about Orenthal James. He had this sudden flight to Chicago. Wrong. That flight was planned way in advance. Like, just lying all the time. Geronimo Pratt, just lying and lying. What do you mean, previous lineup? What do you mean, and identified somebody other than Geronimo Pratt? No. I didn't know that. What do you mean? Julius Butler is an informant. No. I didn't know nothing about no Julio Butler. Yeah. But Rafael Perez is the greatest liar in the history of the world. Right next to O.J. Simpson. And he has a Wikipedia page. David Kenner does not. Let's see. I'll do, oh, wait a minute. Let me get one of our investors who wrote in. He had to say, chapter 10, by the time Perez finished talking his confession was 50 hours and 2,000 transcript pages long. More than 70 of his fellow officers had been implicated in the crimes. I wonder what the racial classification of other officers implicated were. Did Perez avoid implicating any white officers? Good question. Number two. Perez came across as entirely forthcoming about his own career as a drug dealer. Except for 3 kilos, he had led to his detection of all the cocaine he stole from property division was delivered to him by courier at Rampart Station, Perez said. He had placed all the couriered dope, replaced all the couriered dope with Bisquick. The lax protocols regarding drug evidence suggests to me that this was by design and that using drug confiscation to make extra money was much more widespread among white officers than the text would imply. I agree like 1,000,000,000%. Like, come on. Jesse Ventura, former governor in Minnesota, he said the same thing about prisons up there. Like, you are not going to tell me the only officer in the rampantly rogue LAPD to be stealing cocaine or any other valuables, robbing drug dealers, is Rafael Perez. You're out of your mind. You're out of your mind. And how does this book get written? No mention of the Christopher Commission? And even Mark Furman, like, the stuff that, is it just me? The stuff that they're accusing Rafael Perez of doing, and he may have done everything that they said and more. I'm not, you know, trying to stick up for him at all. I'm just saying, like, this sounds exactly like what they talked about with Mark Furman in with the Christopher Commission and in the O.J. Simpson book. Is that just me? Remember that? Blood all over the walls. We went out and washed ourselves off with a hose and ran. I didn't hear that. How do you write this book? And you mentioned Rodney King, Randall Sullivan, and O.J. Simpson, and he's a for sure murderer, and Okay, if all of that's in context, like, man, I thought we read all, I thought the very same L.A. Times, they reported about all this. No, so the only gangsters, Mark Furman and that activity, that's not gangster activity. That's not gangbanger activity. It's just Rafael Perez. Gotcha, Randy. Let's see. Let's look at my notes here. All right. Shortly before the search of the Perez residence, Fred Miller had responded to increased pressure to make something happen in the Biggie Smalls murder investigation and silence pool by orchestrating a series of raids on the Death Row Records production companies and on assorted homes and businesses owned by Suge Knight. A fishing expedition, Suge Knight's latest attorney, Robin Yanes, called it, and Russell Poole agreed. I warned everyone that was going the wrong way, that was the wrong way to go, Poole recalled. To get to a guy like Knight, you have to go from the bottom up, and the cops who worked for him were the best way to do that. Those guys were the weak link, and I think that a lot of them would have rolled over if they'd been brought up on charges, criminal charges especially. I want to pause right here. They said Death Row Records was already in under investigation. Suge Knight had a long criminal record. You're not going to tell me that we have to strategize about the best way to go after this nigra. Are you joking? They already had informed. Like, you have thoroughly infiltrated every black organization in the history of the known universe. You haven't infiltrated Death Row. You don't have like 50 Julio Butlers just waiting with recordings, beatings, anal rapings, everything that we've heard. You don't have that information. You could do that with the Black Panthers, but somehow Death Row Records, they have figured out we don't have no Julio Butler snitches around here. Pshaw. Let's see. Oh, I stopped mid-paragraph. Let me continue. Those guys were the weak link. Oh, this is the officers. I've seen it before. Once these guys are in court and the system, they know they're facing prison time. They will talk. Cops understand better than anybody that once the arrests are made, it becomes a race to see who can cut a deal first. Now, Death Row Records, they're going out beating people up in public on video. These are going to be very easy people to arrest if you really want to. Again, who are these people? What white people? Oh, David Kenner. I see. Who is this white man, David Kenner, that you can be cool with and you can just go around and commit all kinds of criminal activity and white people are befuddled? They will have to sit down and think and strategize about how best to try to arrest you if they can. I've never had a white friend like that. And even they mess this up. They don't even do the arrest. They just go and get people. No arrest made. Everyone hushes up, decides they have nothing to say, and that's the end of that. Like, are you serious? White people know how to solve cases when they want to. They are generally not befuddled by the likes of Suge Knight. A number of witnesses had seen the suspects fleeing on bicycles from... Make sure I give the full time to that. Okay, so Mickey Thompson, he'd been shot to death. Unsolved murder. A number of witnesses had seen suspects fleeing on bicycles from Thompson's secluded home in the hillside community of Bradbury and identified the pair as black males in their mid-late 20s. When Poole ordered up the composite drawings that had been made of the suspects, he decided that they looked a lot like David Mack and Amir Muhammad, who were 28 and 29 years old at the time. Descriptions of the suspects' height and weights also matched Mack and Muhammad. I was reaching, obviously. Now, Henry in Chicago talked about this passage already. Like, I immediately thought of Brian S. Bentley, mentioned him twice today, at former LAPD. He was on the program, and he said they used to snicker. Those jokes again. He said his fellow white officers, like Russell Poole, would snicker. They would come in, and they would go over, like, suspect wanted for raping, mugging, black male, 28 years old, medium build, no facial hair, approximately 6 inches tall, blah, blah, blah. Then they would go to the next one. Suspect wanted car theft, black male, 6 feet tall, average build, no facial hair. And then they would go to the next one. Burglary, suspect wanted black male. And he said they would just look at me like, man, Brian, can you calm down? What else did you do last night? We got a burglary and a raping. Like, come on, Brian, get it together. He said every day would just make that joke every day that you fit every description, man. Gee whiz, come on. Really? David Mack and Amir, they just fit every description. Did he have a bow tie on, too? I know it wasn't a nigger with a bow tie and a bicycle. If that's it, lock him up right now. Are you flipping? And he acknowledges, I don't have one corn kernel of evidence. I'm what they call fishing. I don't even know what that metaphor. I don't even know what that means. Does that mean that you are just making things up? You're fabricating? I'm just letting my imagination run wild? Is that what that? Let me look up fishing. Let me see what that means. Let's see. Let me get a for reals definition for fishing in this context. Mm-mm-mm. Workplace racism, Friday, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. So we're getting a definition for fishing. All righty, let's see what Merriam-Webster has for fishing. Now, this is probably even going to be one of the deep down, definitely, because they don't even, all of it's going to be associated with the sport and all of that. Okay. Let's see. I'm even struggling to find the slang. Let's see if I can find the slang version of it. Let's see. Can I get one in slang here that gives us an accurate for fishing? What does that mean? I'm not even getting a good slang one for fishing, so I'm struggling to even find a nice definition. What does this mean in this context? Fishing, making things up without proof. I'm sure I'll be able to find one here before we go off the air. I'll get to some of my other notes, and then I'll double back to see if I can. If you've got a good definition for fishing, making things up. Let me even see if that is a synonym, making things up, lying. Is that the same thing as so-called fishing? Let's see. Yeah, I'm still struggling. I'll have to look a little later. Let me get to the rest of my notes, and then we'll wrap up. Let's see. Combine the two documents laid out in an investigation that began with the Gaines-Liga shooting, passed through the Biggie Smalls murder, again, not call it Christopher Wallace, and the Ray Perez dope bust, and culminated in his investigation of the Ismael Jimenez beating. What they described was a contamination of LAPD that had spread from a crew of black cops affiliated with Death Row Records into the Rampart Crash Unit, which had become basically a police gang. So this is basically a black gang in the LAPD. Uh-huh. And former LAPD Chief Bernard Parks is implicated because he's looking at all this and he wants to protect the brothers, the USC brothers that he recruited. I'm not going to let you talk bad about my black brothers. Get out of here. That's the allegation. And Maxine Waters and others may have helped in this cover-up. Fishing. Let's see. Rosenthal had absolutely no street smarts, though, Russell Poole would observe, and that's what made him so wrong for this case. The media later would accuse him of botching the prosecution of Perez, but Rosenthal insisted our case went well. Still, the prosecutor allowed. It was a downtown jury, and Perez was a good-looking, likable guy of mixed ancestry. Pause. Is that cowbell? Like, what does that mean? Mixed ancestry? What is not mixed in? Like, woof, I would have a whole lot of questions about that. Like, what in the world? I don't even know what you're talking about. And then, mixed. What does him having mixed ancestry, what does that have to do with the decision reached by the jurors? What does that have to do with the black jurors? Are you suggesting that the black jurors, the non-white jurors, might have been influenced by him having so-called mixed ancestry, whatever that means. Whew, man. And we get another one. They get non-white people on the jury, and they don't like the way the decision goes, and it's blame the nigger jurors. What is it? Paul, the late Paul Mooney. Blame the nigger jurors. Any non-white people on the jury, and we don't get the decision. Not, man, LAPD has been incompetent for a whole decade. Can't even keep track of the cocaine that they steal from the niggers. They got incompetent prosecutors and the whole nine. Like, no, no, no. These dumb bunny nigger jurors, you ought to get rid of them and all. Heard that before. Read that. That's how we started out. O.J. Simpson. Blame the black jurors. Yes, yes. Yes, yes. And then they didn't play the race card. They played the mixed ancestry card. Let's see. Yeah, the polygraph, all of that to do. I mean, polygraphs are not admissible for a reason. Isn't that O.J. Simpson, too? They spent all that, oh, Rental James failed the polygraph. Like, get out of here, man. Get out of here. I don't want to hear about all that. Let's see. Anything else I want to make sure I get? Any other thoughts folks want to make sure that they share before we get ready to wrap things up? I'm going to look for fishing as well. Any other thoughts folks want to make sure they get in? I say folks are satisfied. I'm going to see if I can take another good look. Definition for fishing. Let's see. All right, so Wikipedia, they have one. Fishing in this context is an expedition, an informal expedition. This is a pejorative term for a non-specific search for information, especially incriminating information. Searching. Let's see if I can find another one before we go out. Let's see. Have one more. Let's see. An investigation that does not stick to a stated objective, but hopes to uncover incriminating or newsworthy evidence. Now that, phew, patience rewarded right there. Let me read that one again. I should even go back and read that sentence to see what do we think. I see. This says, an investigation that does not stick to a stated objective. I think that's important too, because we started out saying that they did the Biggie murder and then it went to the Thompson killing. Like, so not sticking to a stated objective, but hopes to uncover incriminating or newsworthy evidence. Now let me go back and read, and let's see if fishing applies in that context. Let's see. Fishing. Oops, pulled up the wrong book. Reading more important than watching television. All right. Oh, he said reaching. He didn't say fishing. He said reaching. He didn't say fishing, but I think the same would apply. He was reaching, obviously. Maybe I should look that one up too. We'll see reaching and see what that says. Fishing was pretty good though, because newsworthy. Maybe that's some of what this is as well, to get things. I mean, we got a best-selling book and a movie. That was the other thing I meant to share. We heard how Perez was arrested. Wild eyes, and they pulled him over on the side of the road. They had called the helicopter in for backup. He was pulled over. They said he was cool and calm. He looked like he thought it was going to be a shootout. He's got these wild nigger eyes. And oh, no. Okay, he cooperates. I could see his heart pounding through his chest, but he cool, calm, doesn't say a word. Briefcases for my lawyer, right? In the film City of Lies, they should call it Movie of Lies, the arrest of Perez is totally different. They have him out shooting some gangbanger nigger and stealing drugs from him. And Officer Poole sees all of this and intervenes dramatically. He gets on his radio and Poole just shot us up. He is the shooter. He is the shooter. And he goes up. He's like, freeze. Yeah, I should play. I'm going to play it next week. I'll play it next week for the beginning. But he goes, hey, freeze. Put it down. And Perez is like, eh, get out of here. You're too pink. You're not. And she goes to get his gun. And even Officer Poole gets to shoot him. Johnny Depp, he gets to bang. He shoots him. And it's like, oh, my God, I can't believe he shot me. He kicks the gun out of his hand. It gets real dramatic. Macho arrest. Get to shoot this black male and get out of here. You're not going to shapeshift on me. No good. I don't remember who plays him, but he shoots him and all that. I mean, that's not even that. Like, why? You're going to call it City of Lies. There's so many lies that we're going to give the truth. And I know it's, I'm not even going to call it a dramatization. I know this is fiction. Talk about reaching. This is fiction. I get it. But why is that fictionalized? That's not what happened at all. You could have just had a scene if you think that's what it is. He sold him drugs. Okay. Show the arrest. That's pretty. A show a nigga with his wild eyes and a helicopter over it. Like, right? Nah, nah, nah. We got to do all this other. Whatever. Same film where they make Randall Sullivan into Forrest Whitaker. Everybody satisfied? Zoom folks are good. We'll probably have two sessions left before we can conclude. Reading is more important than watching television. Footnotes are very important. References, evidence, extremely important. Follow logic. Like, wow, I can't say it enough. People start saying Biggie shot Tupac at least in 1994 and maybe killed him, and then he bragged about it. Keith Murray too. We'll be here tomorrow. Neutralizing Workplace Racism. Much obliged for folks who tuned in. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Lots of reported alcohol, drug use, consumption, distribution even in the text. White people benefit from all of that in a variety of ways, even in spreading lots of malicious lies about us as gangbangers, drug peddlers. In addition to being sober, if you're going to be out and about, be alert. Fire truck just going by. We heard the siren. Be alert to what's happening around you. Not a time to engage. You should be thinking if someone is being hostile out in public, they're probably armed. They've had lots of reports about gun crimes and new gun owners and all the rest. Lots of armed, unstable people, especially in the U.S. right now. You see someone out in public being rowdy, potentially violent. Exit. You should be thinking this person could be armed and might have, in fact, a whole entourage of armed buddies who are ready to kill. If you did not leave your residence prepared to kill and or die, exit immediately. All of that said, we're also, if you're going to go out, you're buckled. If you're driving, doing the small things we can to minimize contact with enforcement officials. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm up. A victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.